This podcast is part of the Erotica Podcast Network, which includes the Erotica Podcast, Erotica Sci-Fi and Fantasy, Erotica Loving Wives, and the Spotify podcast Erotica Taboo Podcast for more intense sexual themes. Both the Erotica Podcast and the Erotica Taboo Podcast offer $2 subscriptions, which opens up bonus content. Links for everything are in the podcast description. This podcast contains mature content and is intended for an adult audience only. It contains explicit words, thoughts, and ideas. The content of all stories is fiction, with any similarities to real people or events being purely coincidental. This podcast is not intended for anything but entertainment of the listener, and if you do not agree with the themes listed in the tags, please do not listen to the story. All characters engaging in sexual relationships or activities are 18 years old or older. This story was found on a free website and brought to audio form here. I did not write and take no credit for this story. Please visit the link in the comments to further support this author. The Fall of Women by Electa Shadow. Author's note: given the peculiar nature of the subject matter, this story warrants a special disclaimer. This is a fantasy, not a manifesto. As famous erotica author Aldis Roadworks usually puts it, "My kinks are not my politics." Do not use this story to promote a political worldview. Practice your relational life consensually, or not at all. I want to say a few extra words before we begin. The concept behind this story isn't exactly new. Many authors have put together stories where women lose their rights progressively or all at once, politically or through supernatural foul play. They've tackled the subject through a variety of tones, some lighter, some darker. As is my trademark, I've decided to focus on the psychological element of submission and on emotional sadism. Be warned that this is a long story, and it takes a while to get to the sex, but the payoff will hopefully be all the greater for it. As always, all characters are over the age of 18. Now, without further ado, enjoy the read. 1. A War in the Mind. My smartphone buzzes in the darkness. I stare daggers at it, as it vibrates on the nightstand. It's just my alarm clock, but for a second, I'm almost tempted to grab the thing and throw it out the window. Except, what good would that do? The damage has been done already. Destroying my phone won't fix anything. I turn off the alarm, retreating back into the blankets, and closer to the warmth of Leah's sleeping body next to me. I put my head on the pillow, close my eyes, and listen to her breathing for a moment. It's peaceful. I wish we could stay like this all day. I wish I didn't have to face the world. Honestly, after what's being done to us women, I feel like I'm kind of entitled to a full day spent resting in bed. Unfortunately, even that isn't an option. Even sleeping is not safe, not anymore. Another bad night? Leah asks in a whisper, almost startling me. I thought she was asleep. I don't answer. I shuffle closer to her, pulling her tight into my arms. We don't need words right now. We've talked plenty enough, and besides, we both share the same dreams anyway, as does every woman unlucky enough to own a phone. My dreams have been a minefield ever since the event. The images are blurry and confused, but their purpose couldn't be any clearer than this. They're meant to change me, rewrite me, convert me. I dream of hands not the soft, warm, feminine hands I like, but the strong, wiry hands of powerful men. They touch me, clenching around my throat, cupping my breasts, squeezing my thighs. Their hands push me against the wall, and in the dreams I'm always breathless, excited, vulnerable. I always end up spreading my thighs a little, making myself open and available, or close my lips around an offered finger, sucking and moaning. And then the hands reach for my shoulders, or my head, and push me down, onto my knees. I dream of collars too. Held by male hands, offered to me, ready to close around my neck. I always wake up restless and exhausted after that. It's starting to affect my mood, my ability to focus. I haven't had a proper night's sleep since the event, and unfortunately, there's no medicine or remedy that will help. The only way I can sleep soundly again is given to the programming. Sounds simple, doesn't it? Abandon my lesbian orientation, forsake feminism, do away with any notion of consent, give up my human rights, and accept a collar from a man. My hands ball into fists, my nails digging into my palms. Whoever developed this payload deserves to burn in hell. Troubled sleep, torture, brainwashing all to get us to accept, no, demand the disenfranchisement of our entire gender. I'll be damned if I let them have me. I hate this. I say in a low whisper. I hate them. All of them. I know. Leah says, pulling me tighter into her arms. Her warmth quells my sadness, but not my anger. I can't wrap my mind around the idea that someone went through the trouble of developing something so outlandish, for such an evil purpose. The affront, the disgust, the violation I feel is making me shake with hatred and rage. Leah seems to notice. She rolls away from me, just enough that we can look each other in the eyes. Are you sure about this? The plan, I mean. I scan her eyes, trying to read her emotions as my eyes adjust to the dark. I honestly don't know. How could I know? I don't even know what we're dealing with, not really. I'm no developer. I certainly can hack into the payload and find out what it does, or how to reverse engineer it. People far smarter and more well-paid than me are working on it round the clock. All I can do is try and resist the payload until then. Prolong my resistance, at all costs. Buy time, until someone figures it out and fixes everything. I must have spent, dozens of hours browsing the internet for clues. Shortly after the event, many women simply abandoned or destroyed their smartphones, but of course that's no solution. The payload's programming is in our brains now. There's an abundance of many other, peculiar remedies out there, and most sound completely and utterly bonkers. But there is one that does sound logical. It's the only hope I can see. I can't show weakness to Leah. I've always been the dominant partner in this relationship, and not just in bed. Now more than ever, she needs my guidance. She needs me to be strong for her. We can trust Reinhardt. I know we can. She whispers. That's not what worries me. What if? She swallows, gathering herself. What if it doesn't work? What if indeed? The truth is, I have no answer for her, not an honest one anyway. But I fear the despair that would overcome her if I say that. Any hope, no matter how meager, is worth fighting for. So I affect a confidence I don't actually feel, and nod. It will work. Many others have tried it. Oh, okay. She says, deferring to me as usual. Unfortunately, while she may be placated for now, I feel terribly antsy. Wordlessly, I slide out of bed and walk out the bedroom. I need to talk to Reinhardt right now. Reinhardt is a morning person. Unsurprisingly, he's already awake and fully clothed, sat at the kitchen table, nursing on an energy drink before he starts his workday. We've been friends since high school. I've always suspected him to carry a bit of a torch for me, but he knows I'm a lesbian and has never expressed any interest openly. For which I'm grateful. That's exactly the sort of reason why Reinhardt is the one male person I would trust in this predicament. He's a great friend, and I know he won't take advantage of my situation. In fact, I thank my lucky stars that he was visiting me when the event happened. He's a digital nomad, and needs only his laptop to work, but what began as a friendly visit became something else when the payload hit. He's been grocery shopping and generally interfacing with the outside world for us, minimizing our interactions with other people. That's good. It's just, not safe to be around men now, even in public. Even less safe than it's ever been before. I join him at the table, but don't touch the biscuits I would normally attack for breakfast. I've lost my appetite. Reinhardt puts down his smartphone and looks at me, concern clear on his face. Good morning, he says cautiously. How are you doing? I gesture vaguely to try and communicate that it was another bad night, and that I don't really want to talk about it. Truth is, I can barely sit still right now, and not just because I'm antsy. Even just being in the presence of a man is a threat to my sanity. Immediately, the payload begins to bombard my mind. It's like he has this sudden aura about him. Tall, strong, with deft hands from playing the violin, and those piercing eyes, green and flecked with gold. If not for the payload, I'd never pay attention to a man's eyes in a million years. I shake myself out of the disgusting reverie, fighting my programming with all my might. Control. I need to stay on top of my own head, and focus. What about you? I croak, forcing myself to have a normal conversation. Slept well? Reinhardt shrugs. Woke up a bit after dawn, been reading ever since. He nods in the direction of his phone. What about? His eyes narrow, as if he's trying to evaluate how to broach his answer. The, event, mostly. Speculation and commentary. Investigation into the group that did this. Right. So much for normality. It must make for thrilling reading, I'm sure. Reinhardt raises his hand, apologetically. Sorry, it's just that. Nobody knows who these guys even are, let alone why they went to such lengths to accomplish their goal. Single-minded fanaticism like that. Doesn't matter why they did it. I say in a hush. I can appreciate Reinhardt's intellectual interest in the subject, but as a victim, my own perspective is a tad different. They're monsters, all of them. Of course, he says. We stare at one another in awkward silence for a moment, before I muster the courage to speak once more. Reinhardt, I think Leah and I want to go ahead with what we discussed. Just getting the words out makes me feel better. It's a load off my chest. It isn't for Reinhardt, though. He leans forward, steepling his hands, looking at me with an inscrutable expression. He often gets like that when he's lost in thought. Really? Are you sure? Audrey, I don't know. Please, I say. Don't balk on me now. I want to tell him that he's my friend, and he can't abandon me now. I almost blurt out that his gender has betrayed mine in a way I never even thought imaginable, and he has a responsibility to help me escape a fate of oppression. But that would be unfair. Reinhardt has nothing in common with the people who did this. I do know he cares for me, and I understand that the situation is bizarre for him, too. So I just plead with my eyes, and let him think through whatever is swirling through his mind right now. It's not that, he says at last. It's just a nominal collaring. Audrey, seriously? I really don't know that I would be advising it. Lots of people are doing it. I say, trying to stop my hands from shaking. Especially lesbians and gay men. Lots of people are trying it, Reinhardt says, cocking his head inquisitively. But how do we know that it's working? Does the payload's programming distinguish between a real and a nominal collaring? What happens if, say, I don't know, okay? I say, realizing only too late that I've shouted. I put my hand over my mouth, in sign of apology. Reinhardt can get very intense, at times. Should a topic catch his interest, he'll dive into it with thorough enthusiasm. His sharp, insightful ability to always bring what actually matters into focus is one of his most compelling traits. But not today. Today, I need a friend supporting me, not a lecture. Even so, I shouldn't have raised my voice. Reinhardt seems unperturbed. He composes himself, sitting a little straighter, and nods for me to continue. Sorry, I say. It's just, man, I can't even sleep at night. I just can't take this anymore. You're right, he says, nodding in understanding. My apologies. I bite my lower lip, looking down at the table, then back up at him. Let's try it, okay? And if it doesn't work, then we'll see. But you're the only person I'm willing to trust with this. You can't quit on me now.
I see, he says, nursing his energy drink, lost in his thoughts once more. At last, he seems to make some kind of determination. He puts down his drink, and nods in my direction.
Tell you what, let's make a deal. I'm willing if you are, but give it another few hours at least.
Think about it some more, okay? I would rather you didn't agree to something you might end up regretting.
Okay, sure. I say, conceding.
Thank you, Reinhard. You're my best friend.
You too, Audrey. He says, booping my nose. The tender moment squeezes my heart a little.
I'll think about it on the way to uni.
I say, standing up. That catches his attention. Uni? He says.
Do you want me to accompany you? I've got some work to do, but I could bring my laptop, I guess.
No need. I tell him, trying to reassure myself as much as him.
Look, I've been basically locked indoors since this whole thing started. I'm not letting the bastards who did this take away my life. Even if I avoid coloring, what do I achieve if I skip all my classes? Then they win anyway.
Reinhard seems to see my point. He gives me a warm smile, the one he reserves for moments like these, when he's manifestly proud of me.
You're right. You go get them, Tiger.
Later in the morning, as I head out in the baggiest clothes I could find, my face half obscured by a scarf and a face mask, my hair tied into a ponytail and tucked in under my hat. I admit to myself I feel like a scared kitten, not a tiger. But at least now I have a plan. And so I steel my resolve and head out the door into a world forever changed. I'm not sure what I expected the world to look like, exactly. I've minimized my exposure to the outside as much as I could in the wake of the event. I've been nursing this fear that I would step out and see. I don't even know what. Something terrifying. But at a first glance, things look remarkably normal. People walk the streets, commuting to work or jogging in the park. I find it reassuring, and feel way more settled as I make my way towards campus. It's only a 15-minute walk away, but I've barely covered half distance before I run into the first visible sign that the event did happen, that it wasn't just my imagination. As I turn the corner, I suddenly find a small, improvised rally women of all ages, but mostly university students like me, holding signs aloft and chanting slogans. There's a few men in there, too, which is certainly good to see. I catch a few of the banners and signs.
Hands off women, says one.
A bunch call for undoing the payload, or demand the people responsible for the event be found and brought to justice. That makes me smile inwardly. We will fight back. We're not going to take this lying down, not this time. I'm half tempted to join them, and class be damned, but I have some time to decide. Apparently, we're traveling in the same direction.
Non-consensual coloring is rape.
I hear one of the girls say in animated discussion, with a guy nodding in agreement next to her. Like, isn't that literally obvious? You're making a woman your slave because she can't say no, even if she's unwilling. It's mind-boggling that it hasn't been made illegal yet. The guy answers. And every day they wait. He doesn't need to finish the sentence. I do my best to push the mental image of a collar the leather, the lock sealing my fate, a hand cupping my chin out of my head, and take stock of my surroundings. I can see the main university building just across the street. Makes sense that protesters would gather here. To start with, I know very large-scale protests have been taking place worldwide, but to see a small, spontaneous gathering so close to my home really lifts my spirits. For a time, even though I'm not formally part of the rally, we march as one. It's only when I make my way to the front of the rally that I notice most protesters have stopped. I look around in confusion, before turning to my right, where a young woman holding a megaphone is glaring at a tall, dark figure. I squint my eyes in the direction of the stranger. It's a young man, some kind of neckbeard with a black t-shirt on that reads,
Long live the new order. I too find myself glaring at him, my hands trembling with barely concealed rage. I don't know what infuriates me more, the idea that someone's had a shirt custom made about this terrible event, or the smug grin on his stupid face. Doesn't he get how serious this is? Does he think this is a fucking joke? My very privacy, even my dreams are being violated by men who wish to harm me and my freedom. And every woman in the world is going through the same nightmare. How can the idea amuse him? The girl with the megaphone, some kind of informal ringleader I suspect, closes the distance between them, the megaphone swinging at her side. For a second I wonder if she's going to hit him. I hope not, but I would enjoy her having a few choice words for this prick. If he's intimidated, it doesn't show. He's ridiculously outnumbered, but has no problem staring down an entire rally, grinning like an idiot. He doesn't take us seriously, I realize. He thinks the payload's turned us into a bunch of zombies. At last, the girl steps right up to him, glowering. He raises an eyebrow in challenge, but just as she's about to speak, he cuts her off.
Like the shirt? He says, his cocky grin growing even wider. What you going to do about it, girl?
I hold my breath, waiting for the inevitable shouting match that's about to follow. But nothing happens. The girl seems to visibly deflate before my eyes, taking one step back, as if intimidated.
I take notice of the megaphone trembling in her hands.
What?
That's what I thought. The guy says, not smiling anymore, he's looking down at her like he's just stepped on a bug. Enjoy the parading while it lasts, bitch, because I guarantee you as soon as someone puts a collar on you, you can forget ever being allowed to do something this silly, ever again.
If the girl looked strangely intimidated before, she now seems to shrink before him, meek and mellow, unable to raise her voice or utter anything more than a feeble protest, which I can't even hear. All her strength, pride, independence, it's all gone. Her own brain is doing this to her, thanks to the payload. Slowly and systematically removing every weapon and defense she's ever had, until she's nothing but a harmless little girl in the presence of a man. The guy laughs right in her face, stalking off. I stand there, petrified, my brain suddenly bombarded with traitorous images. In my mind's eye, the guy doesn't stalk off. He stands there, staring down the girl until she slides down to her knees, megaphone cluttering to the floor. He swipes her hair out of the way to slide a collar around her neck. Hands strong and wiry, twine her hair in circles like he's shortening a pet's leash. She looks up at him, neck strained, eyes full of fear and devotion. I snap out of it, pumping a fist against my thigh. All the hope I felt just a moment ago feels shattered, and I begin to tear up. Leaving the house was a mistake. Pretending I could have a normal day was a mistake. It's not safe to be around men. I know, in my heart of hearts, that the guy could have collared the girl if he'd wanted to. If he'd commanded her to accept it. Hell, he could have collared me. But I've come too far to just go back. Like I told Reinhard this morning, if I give up my education, the misogynists win anyway. I just have to go in there, be careful to avoid men as much as possible, and if one tries to take me over, resist with all my might. And hope that it is enough. One day, someone will pay for making me feel so insecure, so scared, for all the extra emotional labor I have to do to ensure my safety. And I know that day is coming soon. Or maybe it's not. Maybe we'll end up crushed, put in our place, putty in the hands of men. I try to ignore the seditious part of me that seems to purr in pleasure at the idea. But for now, I make my way into the university, feeling like a sheep strolling right into the middle of a wolf's den. Uni is, oddly enough, a breath of fresh air. While the governments of the world shuffle their feet uncertainly, hesitating and dickering, this is where the real mobilization is taking place. Support groups are springing all over like mushrooms. Pamphlets recommend best practices. Always travel in groups, the larger the better. Keep interactions with men to an absolute minimum to minimize the risk of collaring. Of course, the university administration has been slow to react, to the shock of absolutely nobody. So, a range of spontaneous initiatives is filling the gap until, hopefully, the higher-ups wake up. Women are starting to only attend classes held by female professors. With the help of collaborative guys, classes are being kept monogendered as much as possible, which leaves a bad taste in my mouth, but I see no other way. Any length of time spent in the company of a man might be incredibly dangerous, depending on his intentions. At least something is being done. I tell myself this is probably the only reason why the day goes by somewhat uneventfully, why no male student has even tried to hold a prolonged conversation with me, much less tried to collar me. It's sad that the world has to be like this for a while, but look, I didn't develop or deploy the payload. I didn't cause the event. I'm just trying to survive in a world that has suddenly become a lot more hostile. And so I find myself chatting with a few girls I haven't seen since before the event, especially Cindy. We stay back after our elective bioethics class is finished, gossiping and discussing recent events. My absence from uni was a few days longer than hers, and she looks very happy to see me. Almost relieved, in fact. For a while I was worried you wouldn't come back at all. Cindy tells me, squeezing my hand. I'm so happy you're here. Me too. I say, offering her a warm smile. Although I can't blame girls who choose to stay at home. Just coming here today was... I shake my head, sighing. Come to think of it, there are definitely fewer female students around than before the event. Again, hardly surprising. Something flickers across Cindy's eyes, an emotion I'm not quite sure how to identify. Her lips narrow as she stares at me, suddenly looking very serious. Audrey. I arch my eyebrow. What? What's wrong? Cindy shakes her head. I mean, of course you're right. Some are going to bunker down until it's over, and I can't blame them, but that's not what I meant when I said I was happy you made it here. A faint chill trickles down my spine. I gulp nervously. W, what did you mean, then? There are other reasons why a girl may be skipping class. Cindy says, her voice falling to a whisper. You remember Frida? What about her? Cindy stops for a second, struggling to find the words, and to fight back the tears. She, huh? She makes a small circular gesture with her hands, and I hate that I recognize immediately what it means. Frida got collared. Cindy clears her throat, mustering the courage to continue her story. I just listen, stunned. Her new, huh, owner, I suppose, I don't even know who he is, says she doesn't need a degree. So she's not coming back to class. Like ever. Then, her eyes widening, she rushes to amend her statement. Not until they fix everything, I mean. I'm too stupefied to pay much attention to her self-correction. My brain is in shutdown, as a battle rages between two conflicting impulses, my fury at Frida's fate, and the traitorous thoughts implanted by the payload, trying to whisper in my ear. In the perfect stalemate, I only have room for a kind of muted stupor. She was about to publish a legal article. I say, in a whisper. She wanted to be a lawyer. Like me. Cindy shrugs. Well, that's out the window. He wants a housewife, so... I'm going to feel sick. I clutch the edge of the table, trying to steady myself as vertigo threatens to overwhelm me. Frida's life, years of hardship and struggle, studying and brilliance, it was all fundamentally altered by a single encounter. A man's word, and all of it was undone. She was immediately made lesser, reduced, pushed back into a traditional role. A submissive role. I hate how hot the idea sounds, to my payload-addled brain. At the stroke of a pen, her life has been destroyed. No wonder men enthrall us, if we fold so easily. God, the rush of power Frida's owner must have felt, as he literally took her identity away. It must defy description. So many years of delusions about being a man's equal, and look at her now, forbidden from even showing up in class. No more pressure, responsibility, decisions. All she has to worry about now is please her master. She probably spends more time on her knees than standing up, now. To clean the floor, of course, but also to slide under his desk while he does important work, providing for the household. A leash clipped to her collar. I slap my forehead, growling in anger, doing all I can to keep control of my brain. One look at Cindy's flushed face tells me everything I need to know. She's been struggling with it too. That's what really makes me snap. I can't go on like this, not indefinitely. If even Frida, strong-willed, outspoken feminist Frida can fall, then so can I. I need to act, and there's nothing to gain by waiting. I grab my phone, furiously typing a message to Reinhardt. It's only a few simple words, but it's all the words I need. We're doing this tonight. His answer comes seconds later. All right. Guess I'll go by the collars. 2. A leathered splendor. One last time. Reinhardt says, staring at us plaintively. I'm going to point out that I don't think this is going to work. I squeeze Leah's hand, as much to reassure her as to bolster my own resolve. She looks up at me, expectantly. Her big doe eyes never fail to bring out the protector in me. I typically call the shots for the both of us, but I sense a hesitation in her gaze. She knows I just want to plunge ahead with my plan, before my courage falters. Before I can be talked into backing out. But Leah would like to hear Reinhardt out, one last time. I acquiesce with a sigh and a curt nod. Reinhardt must have been studying me just as closely as Leah was, because he resumes his speech immediately. I've been researching this, he says, looking at the two collars he's placed on the table between us. As far as this can be researched at all, of course. But the whole internet is talking about it, and I've been up all night reading. I stare at him with skepticism, and a little bit of annoyance. Reinhardt, I'm not stupid. I can use the internet too. It's frankly astonishing how quickly WikiHow put up guides on collar avoidance. I know, Reinhardt says defensively, holding up his hands. But you were mostly looking at ways to dodge collaring. I decided to try something else. I think if you want to understand how the payload works, you need to look at, catcher spaces. I see the old intensity in Reinhardt's eyes, which tells me this has become an absorbing interest for him. He hasn't just been researching it, he's probably been reading all day, trying to understand what makes all of this tick. I'm hoping it will come to our advantage. His analytical mind is a great asset to have in this situation. But for now, I need to try and keep up with hours upon hours of immersion that he needs to condense for me. Catcher spaces, I say. And what are those? Reinhardt shrugs, seemingly uncomfortable with himself. Catchers are men who have already collared a woman. Or more. There are forums and chat rooms where they gather and debate. I shouldn't be surprised, I really shouldn't. But I grit my teeth in anger and disgust all the same. I don't even. What do they even talk about exactly? How it's our fault for being collared because we dared refuse a sexual advance from them, or wore too short a skirt. Some of that is definitely going on. Reinhardt says, his distaste unclear. But mostly advice, you know. Even some analysis. My eyes widen, my nails dig into my palms, and my own mind begins to accelerate. I know I really, really shouldn't ask the question that's about to come out of my mouth. I don't know whether it's curiosity or the payload that finally makes me say it. What kind of advice are we talking about? Mostly on the most effective ways of catching women, and how to properly domesticate them after their collaring. Domesticate them. The word swirls in my brain, tainting every thought, every image. It feels so wrong and so right at once. Of course, most animals can be domesticated. Why should humans be any different? Why should women? My knees tremble, and Leah next to me is basically beginning to sway. But Reinhardt talks on, oblivious. Most men don't really have a clue, he says. But a few are very vocal and extremely detailed in their guides. Their mission seems to share certain techniques they have found to yield wondrous and terrifying results. I swoon in place, struggling for balance as the payload assaults my perception. Certain techniques. I can certainly believe that. Take a young woman, strong, smart, fiercely independent, keenly aware of her worth and her right to equality. Then strip everything piece by piece. Make her dependent, insecure, unassuming. Assign her simple caregiving tasks, dulling her intelligence through repetition and labor. Use rewards and punishments to steer her, mold her, remake her. Domesticate her. And Reinhardt stayed up all night reading about how to best break a woman. It really is terrifying. And in a way, it really is wondrous. I slap my forehead again. Reinhardt blinks, taken aback for a second, before resuming his speech. He's learning to take such reactions in stride, I guess. I'm actually a little suspicious of these users, by the way. They seem a little too eager to help. It only makes sense that whoever designed the payload also disseminated as much information out there to maximize its effect. Leah whimpers next to me. I turn to face her, in shock. That's the kind of submissive meal she would reserve for me, when I push her onto the bed and make her beg for pleasure, or when I climb my way up her body, to straddle her face with my thighs. I'm not sure Reinhardt's noticed. You see the brilliance of the plan? He asks me. The payload makes it so that things implement themselves. It's got the authorities in a bind. Their only option is to find a fix to reverse the payload. In the meantime, there isn't much they can do to counter its effects. Is that a hint of admiration I detect in his voice? Is he impressed by how thoroughly these misogynists planned out the downfall of womankind? Is that what Leah was mewling about? I think I'd be much happier if they hadn't done such a good job. I say, my voice dripping with sarcasm. In truth, I'm nowhere near as cocky as I sound. The performance is meant to reassure me that I can still handle all of this. Of course, Reinhardt says, snapping out of his elucubrations. In any case, that's not the point. The point is, I'm becoming convinced that the collars are a red herring. Right, exactly. I say, that's what I've been saying. We can satisfy the payload with a pantomime, and that's it. But Reinhardt shakes his head. No, Audrey. The collars are a red herring for you. For all of us. I blink at him in confusion. What I mean is this, the collar is just an object. By focusing so much on it, we're getting distracted from how the payload actually functions. It makes you want to serve men. That's a lot more insidious than just a circle of leather. A shiver trickles down my spine. It makes sense, but I want to deny it, because if he's right, how do you fight something like that? That's why I said they have the authorities in a bind. Reinhardt continues. Think about it, why hasn't collaring been banned yet? There's a weirdly, enthusiastic glint in his eye. He doesn't wait for me to try and fumble out an answer either. You could outlaw every piece of leather on the planet, Reinhardt says, looking me in the eyes. But how do you stop someone from choosing to just obey? To submit? It's the collaring that's the pantomime. The obedience, now, that's real. For a second, it's like the entire world around me holds its breath. My stomach drops, and there's a knot in my throat. It's all I can do to keep the dread at bay. It's hard to argue with Reinhardt's logic, which makes me feel even more humiliated and diminished. I know that's just my brain trying to self-sabotage, the programming trying to convince me I'm better off letting a man do the thinking for me. Obey, submit, I hear, in his voice. Obedience, now, that's real. I find myself staring in awe, battling for control of my mind, as Reinhardt continues his explanation. The front line of this war is in here, he says, tapping his forehead. Inside the mind. I open my mouth, looking for a rebuttal, but none comes. I know he's right. But I also know I can't just keep fighting the payload. My very vacillation right now is proof of this. In fact, if he doesn't shut up, I think I'll end up on my knees no matter if he agrees to the ritual or not. So I shrug, cutting the discussion short while I still can. Well, say you're right. Do you have a better plan in mind? Reinhardt leans back a moment, blinking, thinking. Then he sighs, lowering his head. I suppose I do not. Leah and I exchange a look. She gives me a tiny nod, which is all I need. I know she's going to trust me with this, follow me into the breach. We'll figure it out together. After all, we love one another, and Reinhardt is our friend. That has to be stronger than any smartphone virus. Hasn't it? I snap back to reality as Reinhardt clears his throat. Let's get this over with, come on. I nod, with a final squeeze on Leah's hand to lend her strength. And then, together, we flex our legs and begin descending to our knees. We do it in perfect sync, like we've rehearsed this 1,000 times. Of course, we haven't even talked about it. But the ritual is etched into the brains of every woman now. Every tiny motion, every element of choreography, it's been drilled into us, night after sleepless night. In our dreams of male dominion and female submission. I hate kneeling, of course. Even if it's just pantomime and it's Reinhardt. The twin symbolism of subservience and sexual innuendo isn't lost on any of us. But as I sink lower, my eyes widen in surprise at how my body feels. The payload, I realize. It's working overtime to exploit this opening. It's like a great weight has been lifted off me. I get a second wind, blasting away the fatigue and sleep deprivation of the last few days. I feel lightheaded, but also energetic. When my knees hit the floor with a fateful thud, part of me thinks that this is a hugely significant, almost profound moment. It's the part that the payload's corrupted, I know. But it's in there, and I can't block it off, not while performing the ceremony it's been demanding of my brain for days on end. It tells me that I could do worse than Reinhardt. Lesbian or not, even I can sense his magnetism. He's ridiculously eloquent, tall, strong. His green eyes are as piercing as his intellect. He looks soulful, when he plays the violin. With his many intellectual and physical hobbies, he's a modern-day Renaissance man. Surely even a lesbian could see value in accepting such a man's authority over her own life? And of course, his voice such a low octave, the perfect pitch for resonating against a girl's ribcage for commanding her. These are alien thoughts. They're evil and cursed, and wherever they take root, they poison the soil. But as Reinhardt begins to loom over our kneeling figures, one collar in hand, it's hard to avoid the notion that he deserves to rule. That he looks like a king. I hold my breath as the first collar snaps around Leah's neck. Instantly she looks smaller, mousier, less of a person. She's trying to shrivel under his gaze. She immediately bends forward, landing on her elbows, and places a soft kiss on the tip of his black leather shoes. I acknowledge myself owned, she says, breathless, and the sight is like a punch to the gut. That's my girlfriend kissing a man's feet, declaring herself his property. I steady my breathing. It's all for show. None of this is real. But the constant warring between my programming and my rage is leaving me exhausted and confused. The confusion melts away when Reinhardt steps right into my field of vision, holding the second collar right in front of my face. Every neuron in my body flares up. The response is incredible, all-encompassing, a chasm of pure sensation that threatens to swallow me whole. My breathing comes in short, ragged pulses as Reinhard sweeps my hair out of the way. When the leather touches my skin, a jolt of electricity courses through me. And then I hear it. The click. As the collar closes around my neck, I begin to writhe, every muscle in my body spasming and tensing. I, too, bend forward, because I'm out of breath, and I'm doubling over. The sensation rippling across my body cannot be put into words. It's almost like an orgasm, but not quite. The collar feels good around my neck, thick and tight. I can't even flex my neck too much, its edge presses against my chin if I try. I imagine being forced to keep a straight neck posture, formal and servile, like I'm waiting to be inspected, and that makes me lick my lips. The black glossy leather must make such a fine contrast with the paleness of my skin, one most pleasing to a man's eye. As it should be. But then, the reverie begins to fade. The pleasure retreats, and the collar doesn't feel like a lover's warm embrace anymore, but constrictive instead. I twist my head uncomfortably, trying to work it in a more comfortable position. As I begin to climb down and back to normality, the repulsion returns, making me recoil in place. I'm a lesbian and a feminist, kneeling before a man who's just put a collar on me. And I swear, as I look up at him, there's some weird glint in his eye. Reinhard's face rarely betrays his emotions, but as he contemplates me, kneeling before him, wearing his collar, it's clear some considerable turmoil plays out across his expression. My trust falters. For a second, there's nothing in the world I want more than to just bolt. Start running, and never stop. But I've come this far, and I will not let my doubts poison my friendship. The people behind the payload have done enough damage. This, they won't take from me. I will see this through. So I prostrate myself before my friend, wrinkling my nose at the pungent scent of the leather that hits my nostrils. Closing my eyes, I force myself to place the smallest, least enthusiastic of puckered kisses that I can on the tip of his shoes. I have the horrible suspicion that, pantomime or not, Reinhard won't be able to see me as an equal anymore. Not after I've literally folded myself in such a slavish position to kiss his feet. But I suppress the fear. He's a friend, and he knows this was my only option. And so, at last, I say the words to complete the ritual, hating every single one of them. I acknowledge myself owned. 3. A tame gender. It's a miserable walk to campus. Compared to the first time I ventured out after the event, the world around me is starting to look less and less normal. There are way fewer women around, for starters. I know they're all either bunkering down at home, or kneeling at a man's feet. Of those that do make the rounds, several are in the company of a man. Some are openly being led by leashes, or simply walk around wearing their master's collar. Every street corner, every newspaper, every conversation the event dominates it all. The world I knew is coming apart at the seams before my very eyes, as women fall and men cast their shadows upon them. I've diligently avoided social media and the internet for the past day, but I could hear Reinhard pacing the house last night, and I know he's been up again, immersed in his reading. I wonder if he's still lurking in catcher spaces. I wonder if that's what the glimmer in his eyes is about, when we meet in the morning. I grimace, thinking back to the way this day began. I made coffee for Reinhard, this time even though he was up before the sun had even risen. I woke up, went straight to the kitchen, and fixed him coffee. I didn't even know why. It just seemed like the most natural way to begin the day. He accepted it too, with a muttered thanks, and no acknowledgement beyond that. I rub my temples, trying to chase away the sense that I'm slipping down the spiral of the payload. Friends make coffee for one another all the time. There's no need to overthink this. I'm not like them, like all the women around me who are wearing their collars, walking with eyes downcast and dainty steps. Well, I suppose I'm one of them in a way. I, too, have my collar on. Of course the difference is that, in my case, it's only for show. I can feel the hungry eyes of every man around me as I walk down the streets, alone and unescorted. I can see them look away when they notice I'm already collared. Maybe I should be grateful for that, but I just find it deeply humiliating. I don't even get to establish boundaries for myself. The only thing that will make men decide I'm off limits is when they believe I'm the property of another man. It's his boundaries they're respecting, not mine. It makes me feel like, well, like a thing. There's still a rally in the street leading directly to the university, but it's hard to escape the sad reality that its numbers are dwindling. Not just way fewer women, but fewer men too, which sends a cold shiver down my spine. How many of the guys who marched here on the first day have already given up? How many have collared a girl they had a crush on, or simply happened to pass by in the hallway? The women, at least, are having to fight the programming inside their heads, every second of every day. No wonder even those that showed up look fatigued, despondent, and demoralized. But the guys, what's their excuse? I suppose it doesn't matter. Until the payload is undone, men have no need to justify themselves to us. Not anymore. This is only visibly reinforced when I once again spot the redhead with the megaphone. I see she is, once again, confronting the single guy who keeps showing up every day to mock the protesters. He's wearing a different shirt this time, one that reads, "Ask me for a collar." I swear to God, has he gotten a whole collection of these already? Jesus. Unfortunately, my programming is providing very strong motivation to keep my eyes downcast and keep walking. I wonder what the payload would have me do if I didn't have Reinhard's collar on. Would I gravitate towards him? Wait for his approval, which might well never come. Seek his validation? Ask how I may be of service? As it is, another girl is going through that very experience. Megaphone Girl is trying her best to stand up to him, but she's visibly trembling. I wonder how long she's been trying to muster the courage to tell him off. Trying and failing. My stomach drops at the movement I can barely spot in my peripheral vision. I know, in my heart of hearts, that the girl has fallen to her knees. I know the man has fished out a collar. And I think the sound I'm hearing is that of a zipper being pulled down. I start running. By the time I'm across the street, I already have to stop to catch my breath. Between the pandemic and the event, I've spent so long being a couch potato, and it hasn't done my lung capacity any good. But as my heavy breathing subsides, and I walk the rest of the way to campus, I can hear the sound of the guy's mocking laughter echoing behind me. Tear-eyed and sobbing, aroused and flustered, I compose myself before entering class. I don't want the girls to see me like this. To see my fear and my weakness. When at last I feel calm enough, I make my way to my traditional seat, right next to Cindy in class. It seems the lecture hasn't started yet, which is weird considering how late I am, but I have no chance to ask Cindy what's up with that. She gasps upon seeing me, her eyes wide with horror. Not you too! Huh! It takes me a moment to realize what she's talking about. I look down, suddenly self-conscious, my fingers brushing against the leather collar. Oh, this. No CIN, don't worry. It's only for show. You know, nominal collaring. Oh. Oh God. Cindy says, slumping back in the chair. For a second I thought I... It's not just concern or fear that's making her react like this. I can see the subtle rubbing of her thighs, the way her lips are subconsciously pouting. She wants the collar. When at last she finds the strength to converse with me again, I note her pointed refusal to look anywhere near my neck. She seems to be focusing on my shoes right now. Does that even work? The nominal thing. Does it? That's a good question. Ever since the ceremony, the payload seems to have calmed down a little. I'm getting restful sleep now, but the dreams haven't exactly stopped. Maybe most importantly, I know the programming isn't gone. I can feel it humming in my head, like a parasite, or an ever-turning spiral, twisting and warping every thought, turning my mind inside out and against itself. If it stays at this reduced level of activity, though, I may stand a chance to fight it. So perhaps, while not entirely successful, my plan hasn't failed after all. I guess we'll know for sure soon. I tell Cindy with a shrug. She nods. Just let me know, okay? Because if it does work, then maybe. I squeeze her hand. She doesn't need to say anymore. I know she's losing the fight, I can see it in her eyes. How they go slightly glassy and unfocused whenever a man speaks to her. Unbidden, I imagine how great she'd look like on her knees. With an internal scream of rage, I push the thought down, forcing myself to focus on the here and now. It would be easier if class were to at least start. I look around, noticing the conspicuous lack of our lecturer. Do you know what's going on? Oh, right. Cindy says, with a dejected look on her face. Professor Watkins got collared. What? Yeah. She says in a whisper. Professor Roland did it. He always did resent having to share the subject with her. He's taking over all of her classes and, well, her. I stare at Cindy in shock. I hate that every new day is a litany of horrors. Another heartbreak. Another strong woman falling. They're looking for a female replacement to come teach us today. Cindy says. Since we won't take a male lecturer. It's just, there's fewer and fewer of those and... I guess they haven't found one yet. Or maybe they have, and she was collared on the way to work. What do I know? Chaos. This is chaos. How can this be allowed to continue? I massage my temples, trying to keep the terror at bay. God, Reinhard was right. The insidiousness of the payload is making it impossible to counter it. How do you stop the backslide, if women themselves are being made to ask for the yoke? Don't worry, Cindy. I say. I don't know what's prompting this, but I'm talking to her as I would to Leah. We're going to be okay. I know we are. Oh, Audrey. Cindy says, shaking her head. No, we're not. I'm sorry. I don't believe that anymore. Why not? She looks at me for a moment, confused. Then, she sits a little straighter in her chair. I guess you haven't heard. The flat, empty tone in her voice is making me slip closer and closer to the edge of panic. I've never seen Cindy like this, so resigned, so defeated. The roaring of my own heart thunders against my ears. Heard what? Cindy gulps. Maybe you should just check the news. I return home fueled by hatred and rage. I know my anger is incongruous. I find Leah and Reinhard sitting at the table. Having just finished lunch, Leah had morning classes today, and Reinhard, of course, stayed into work. They look surprised to see me back so early. Hey, love. Leah says. Is everything all right? No. I say, fuming. It's not. They're taking our rights away. Calm down. Reinhard says, and I can tell from his and my girlfriend's expression that they already know. If they do, why are they so composed? Why are they sitting around like it's just another regular day? I feel like I'm losing my mind. Don't tell me to calm down. I shout, my emotions finally overcoming my every effort to bottle them up. This is the biggest single reversal in human rights in modern history. How can you tell me to calm down? I've just lost most of my civil rights, and you're tone policing me? Audrey. Reinhard says, his eyes narrowing. I said calm down. And in that singular moment, I realize the tragic extent of my mistake, because I immediately shut up. I don't really calm down, of course Reinhard doesn't magically control my emotion. But the moment his words leave his lips, the programming whirs to life in my own mind, and my rebuttal dies in my throat. I look around, confused, my mouth opening and closing uselessly. I want to scream and argue, to make my point and curse and weep, but I can do none of that. All I can do is obey. Submit. Obedience, I remember. Now that's real. Femininity is supposed to be docile and proper, the programming tells me. Shouting is unbecoming. Being assertive is a masculine trait. My lot in life is to be seen, and not heard. I shake my head in confusion, trying to fight the morass enveloping my thoughts. I see the effect his words have had on Leah too. She sits back, demurely, looking up at him for approval with big, pleading eyes. My girlfriend. Looking to Reinhardt for approval. That's when I know for sure my plan has failed. The real weakness is inside my own head, and I don't know how to counter it. I have no options, no ideas, and no hope. Reinhardt's not oblivious to any of this, I know. There's something in his expression, a hunger I've never seen before. His hands are trembling. I can never remember Reinhardt looking so out of sorts. He's always the picture of composure and self-restraint. But he's clearly struggling to hold himself back, just as I'm struggling not to fold under his gaze like a silly girl being scolded. But hold himself back from what? As I study his face, I find myself wondering just how long he's spent reading blog posts and catcher spaces. Look, what's happened is perfectly logical, Reinhardt says, breathing in, trying to calm himself down. Think about it. What else can be done? Reduced into humiliating silence, I glare at him. I refuse to dignify the rhetorical question with an answer that would come out far too meek to actually reflect my feelings. Consider the following. Reinhardt continues. I walk up to a woman, collar her, then command her to kill somebody. Can she refuse me? No. It may take time, persistence, determination, but eventually the payload would disassemble her resistance. She would carry out my command, and kill in my name. I let out a surprised yelp at the shiver that goes through me when he says disassemble her resistance. God, why does that sound so hot? Why does it turn my knees to jelly? There would be no way to ascertain she acted on my orders. Reinhardt says. I could order her to lie, even confess she acted alone. If she wears my collar, she is compelled to do as I bid her. So, do you think she should go to jail because I commanded her to kill? Of course not. I say, begrudgingly giving him ground. Exactly. Reinhardt nods enthusiastically. That's why your legal personality's been revoked. For all intents and purposes, women are basically minors now. It's not meant to disenfranchise you, but to protect you. Leah whimpers, squirming in the chair, as Reinhardt begins listing items with his fingers. A man could coerce you to sign a terribly one-sided contract, he says. Or donate all your material possessions to him. Or act as his criminal proxy in any capacity. Of course, such things can't be considered legally binding. And the right to vote? I managed to ask, through gritted teeth, my nails digging into my palms. How does taking that away, rolling me back to the 19th century protect me, Reinhardt? Isn't it obvious? He says. I could just order you to vote for this or that political party. It wouldn't actually be your vote. Men with more women under their control would effectively acquire extra votes. No, it's simply untenable. I see the cold logic, of course. But I despair at the idea that Reinhardt doesn't see the flip side, the raw consequence of this pragmatic approach. It's playing right into the hands of whoever developed the payload. God, I hate how much sense all of this makes. How well thought out the trap is. The margin for our freedom keeps shrinking under my very eyes. Every avenue of escape closed, one by one, until all a woman can do is fall. The yoke is tightening around my neck, around all our necks. And even my best friend is dancing to that tune, as he mansplains my own enslavement to me. He must notice my turmoil, because his expression softens. Look, Audrey, these measures are temporary, I'm sure. It's only until the payload's undone. As soon as women regain the faculty to decide for themselves, I'm sure their rights will be waiting for them. Legal emancipation, the vote, everything. Right. I say flatly, prevented from sharing how I really feel about his optimism. What if it takes 10 years to fix it? What if it's never fixed? What then? Then we'll figure it out. Reinhardt says, using a paternalistic tone that seems to suggest he thinks this closes the matter. That just enrages me even more. Look, you know what this means for me, right? I blink for a second, in confusion. What is he talking about? You're both wearing my collars. Reinhardt says, patiently, like he's talking to a child, and I think my worst fear is coming true. He doesn't see me as an equal anymore. I've never seen this condescending, domineering side of him, and it terrifies me, because I know he has power over me. What's even worse is that the warping effect of the payload makes me think it's hot. Right and proper. That I was made to be taken under a man's wing, and the fact that I'm a lesbian simply makes the humiliation even more delicious. That means I am legally responsible for anything you two do. Reinhardt continues. Now, I have no doubt you're not going to rob a bank or anything, but still, this is a huge responsibility, Audrey. If you fail to do your taxes properly, that's on me. If you ever become indebted, that's on me. He shakes his head. I didn't want to go ahead with the ritual, remember. It's not like I'm looking forward to the liability. I stare at him slack-jawed. I've just lost all my rights. Yes, it sucks that he's now liable, but how can he not see the chasm between our two setbacks? Why can't he show a little empathy? In fact, why did he feel entitled to command me to calm down? I'm about to ask him this very question when Leah speaks up, with a mousy, unassuming voice she's never used, not even when playing sub with me.
"I'm sorry, sir," she says, and I sharply draw in breath at the word sir. "Is there any way we can make it up to you?"
In my complete bewilderment, I can't decide if she means that genuinely, or if she's flirting with him, with me right here in the room with them.
"Leah, what the fuck?"
I manage to blurt out.
"Where is your outrage? Your resistance?
He's bossing us around like we're children. Women's rights have been erased with the stroke of a pen, and that's how you react? You ask him how you can make it up to him?" The look Leah gives me is devoid of any expression. Then, she turns back to Reinhard, awaiting instructions. He in turn studies us both closely, like a lab worker looking at a petri dish. It crushes me to realize it, but Leah's just, defeated. I've seen that look before. She reminds me of Megaphone Girl right now. Knees hitting the floor, a hand on her head, a zipper being pulled down.
"It's fine," Reinhard says, waving his hand. "Just go wash the dishes. Then, the laundry, and then, you may study."
"Yes, sir,"
she whispers, and all the words I could associate with her demeanor rush through my mind, a maelstrom of sexualized images that make me reel backwards into the wall. My girlfriend is subservient, open, available, submissive, obedient. My own best friend has tamed her, is prying her away from me. She's being demoted, made to be docile, unassuming, domesticated. And I'm next. How long before I end up like her? Before my resistance is deliciously, systematically, expertly disassembled? How long before I start to love it? Beg for it? I watch, stunned, as Leah takes the dishes, heading towards the kitchen, like so many women before her, confined and reduced to a helping role in the household. Like so many women right now. Then, at last, my dread wins over the payload, just this once. I bolt into the hallway, rushing towards my room, my heart thundering against my ribcage. I need to act before it's too late. I need to leave. Before I, too, have a chance to fall.
"What are you doing?"
I curse under my breath, struggling to keep my body from snapping to attention at the sound of the voice. His voice. I keep mindlessly throwing clothing into my luggage, fighting to hold my composure. God, I must look like such a cliché. I'm not even paying attention, just dumping a whirlwind of scattered clothes in before I take the suitcase and head out of my apartment. And then,
what?
Back to my parents? I stop for a second, considering the absurd question, has Dad collared Mum already? Maybe they'll do it with good intentions, to prevent other men from potentially collaring her at work. Then, she'll find herself following, submitting and falling. Because there's no such thing as a nominal collaring, and the payload will disassemble us all, until we're all simpering housewives and sex slaves, our entire lives centered on being at the beck and call of men.
"Where do you think you're even gonna go?"
Reinhard says, echoing my own thoughts.
"This thing is everywhere."
I slam the lid of my suitcase, trying to stop my hands from shaking.
"Yes,"
I say, my voice trembling.
"Nowhere is safe."
"It's safe here."
I turn to face him, and even that takes all my residual willpower. The programming demands that I look up at him from my knees, but I won't give in. Even if my resistance is slackening, and my arousal is climbing.
"No, it's not.
Reinhard, I want you to take this collar off."
He arches an eyebrow.
"You can take it off yourself. It's not like I've commanded you to wear it."
"You know exactly what I mean,"
I say, my voice coarse as I try to shout, to sound assertive, and mostly fail. At that, Reinhard just shrugs, but I know it's feigned calm. I can see the twitching of his fingers. The way his lips are quivering. I know he wants to jump me, and he's barely able to contain himself. To the true part of me, that's the most heartbreaking thing that could ever happen to me. But to the part warped by the programming, it would be something else entirely.
"Audrey, I can't remove the payload. Even if I undo the ritual, and free you. You will end up taking orders from a man, until this is reversed. It's just how you're coded, now."
I snarl in frustration. I can almost hear the unspoken "might as well be me" in the air. That really, really wounds me. Worse than even the payload itself, because its developers, at least, are strangers and fanatics. Reinhard has been my friend for so many years.
And what is he now?
"Master," the programming whispers, and I shake my head furiously, like I'm trying to physically throw it off.
"I regret trusting you,"
I say, my words laced with venom.
"Maybe I should have found a gay man to collar me. He wouldn't lust after me the way you are right now. It's because of your crush, isn't it?
Don't think I don't know." For the first time since the event, he actually looks stung, and I know I've hit a nerve. Even his cheeks gain a bit of color, but he still tries to dissimulate.
"Sure, you could have done that,"
he says, ignoring the latter part of my comment.
"But it wouldn't have changed much."
When faced with my skeptical look, he continues.
"Audrey, you still wouldn't be free. It doesn't matter if your master chooses not to give you orders, that's still his decision to make, not yours. You'd still be a slave, pretending at freedom.
I know that," I say, hating that my voice sounds shrill and petulant, rather than assertive and confident.
"What other option do I have? All I can ask for is live a normal life, until this is undone. Do you have the spine to give it to me? To treat me like a thinking adult who can choose for herself?"
I blink, realizing that, in my fervor, I've stepped closer to Reinhard, and right into his personal space. That was a mistake. I'm acutely aware of his physical presence, of his sheer maleness. I feel it pull me in, like a star's gravity well, drawing a planet into its orbit. I take a faltering step back, lowering my voice.
"Did I choose wrong? Do you have the moral temper to do what's right, Reinhard?"
He looks away from me, embarrassed, ashamed. Maybe I've gotten through to him. I dare hope for a moment that he'll return to the person he was before the event. Before the ritual.
You know, Audrey, he says at last, looking back at me. I really thought I did. I was wrong.
And then, he takes a step towards me. I immediately step away, recoiling from his sheer aura, his presence, his magnetism. The payload's reacting to his aggression, working overtime to make me feel smaller and smaller as he draws closer to me. Eventually, my back hits the wall. I feel like a cornered animal, a wild horse about to be wrangled and broken in for the saddle. It terrifies me, but I've been holding out for so long, and the programming is so relentless. I can't deny the quivering in my thighs, the lancing sexual heat that courses through me at the idea of Reinhard placing his boot on my neck and pulling my leash upwards, imposing his manly authority over the defeated lesbian he's craved most of his adult life. Reinhard, I say, realizing I'm running out of options, that every breath of his pheromones, every second he provides fuel for the payload, I draw nearer to my destruction.
Please. Turns out I'm not that kind of person, he says. Too curious. Spent too much time reading vivid descriptions, imagining this moment, how it would feel, the adrenaline, the power.
His hands shoot out to grip my wrists, pinning them against the wall. Strangely enough, my fear is subsiding, sinking down alongside my resistance. A tidal wave of arousal is climbing up, drowning my perception with its thunderous roar.
I shouldn't be doing this, I know, he says, his lips nibbling at my ear. However,
I gasp, altering my stance, spreading my legs a little, thrusting my chest out, to give him easier access. Just like in my dreams. I realize now the dreams weren't simply meant to convert me. They were meant to prepare me. To make sure that, when a man finally decided to stake his claim on me, I would deliver to perfection, satisfy his every expectation. I've never felt this way for a man. Hell, I've never felt this way for a girl, because this isn't really arousal, and this isn't really me. It's my brainwashing, disassembling every piece of me that ever thought I was an equal to a man, and making me love it. How can simple, normal, biological arousal compete with the payload? With a program that was tailor-made to fire every neuron in a woman's body, until her soft feminine brain got literally fried by overloaded levels of impossible pleasure. There's no denying the slick wetness between my legs, the inviting pout of my lips, the dilation of my pupils, or the way my breath is coming in fast and ragged. Reinhard's body presses against mine, and for the first time in my life, an erection touches me. His straining cock pokes at my thigh through his pants and my jeans. It should revolt me, but even that's enough to shock my body with a jolt of electricity.
You never did understand the full power of the payload, Reinhard whispers. And yet I tried to tell you.
Yes,
I say, and it comes out in a throaty, moaning voice that drips with lust.
The true power of the payload isn't its ability to make you submit,
Reinhard says, kissing his way to my throat, gently nibbling at the skin with his teeth.
It's that it makes you want to submit,
he says, smiling at the soft, feminine gasps leaving my throat every time he touches me.
If I were to step away now, you would beg me to claim you.
God, I say, whimpering, realizing I'm pressing myself against his erection. And then, the unthinkable happens. Reinhard does step away. All physical contact ceases as he looks me up and down. The sudden emptiness I feel, the craving for his warmth, for his body slamming mine down with his weight, that's what convinces me he's right. I want this. I want to serve him. That's what's going to break me. The payload isn't going to turn me into a puppet, it's going to make me an addict to my own humiliation. Desperately hooked, and unable to let go. I descend to my knees, throwing myself at his feet, kissing his leather shoes. It's no chase pecking this time. I smooch slavishly, trying to adhere as close to the ground as I can. I realize I'm virtually humping the air right now, like I'm a stupid bitch in heat, completely debasing myself before this man. And the humiliation lances through me like pure arousal, eliciting a desperate, needy moan out of my throat.
I consider myself owned,
I say, in a worshipful tone, like I would a prayer.
I consider myself owned.
I'm begging, hoping, pleading for his answer, his acknowledgement, his validation. But Reinhard says nothing. Instead, it's another fateful sound I hear above me, as I lie prostrate at his feet. That of a zipper being pulled down. For a certain technique. I can't believe this is happening. I've never seen, much less touched a cock in person, and now I'm kneeling before Reinhard, as he pulls it out and starts to stroke it. I stare at his bulging erection with a mix of apprehension and worshipfulness, a combination that would have seemed both corny and ridiculous to me not long ago. But that was before the event. Before the payload. Before the fall.
You don't know half of what the payload is actually capable of,
Reinhard says, his voice dripping hunger.
In fairness, I couldn't believe it either, when I started reading about it.
Reinhard, please. I say, not even knowing whether I'm begging him to stop, or to show me.
I dash.
I don't get to finish the thought. Reinhard draws closer, looming over me, and slaps me. Then, while I'm still reeling, his hand swings again, backhanding me. It's not hard enough to actually hurt, but the sting, the humiliation, his brazen confidence that he can do this to me, take my breath away. And. Oh no. My sex is radiating heat, pulsing in anticipation. I've never, ever been this wet before in my entire life. I look up at him, my eyes widening in shock.
That was so hot.
There's a cruel fire in Reinhard's eyes as he smiles wolfishly.
This will happen every time you're disrespected, debased, or humiliated. And the best part? You'll build up tolerance to it.
No, I say, shaking my head in disbelief at the perfection of the trap.
Yes,
Reinhardt says, his voice steely. You will keep seeking to hide the thrill. You will accept more and more humiliations, just to feel it again. What used to be unthinkably humiliating for you will become your new normal. I stared up at him, wide-eyed, torn between dread and desperate arousal. Even something as simple as the slap has immediately changed me. I feel meeker for it, like he's slapped bitchiness and entitlement and feminism out of me. I reach out, kissing the hand that slapped me, while his other hand tousles my hair. The sound of every kiss is a new seal on my downfall. My own self-sabotaging brain keeps supplying rationalizations for my own demotion. He's bigger and stronger than me. Of course he gets to push me around. I've had to kiss his shoes. What kind of independent person does that? He literally gets to slap me around when I'm being a silly girl. He's talking down to me while I'm acting as a toy for his amusement. And because of the programming, I get wetter every time he says something demeaning about me. His cock slaps my cheeks, making me squeal. Its texture feels odd, hard and soft at the same time, but I still find myself rubbing my cheek against it, like an affectionate pet. Then, his hands twirl my hair, shortening my leash, angling my face towards his cock.
Suck my cock, Audrey,
he says, breathless, and I know this is a dream come true for him.
Worship it with your lesbian lips. Acknowledge your self-owned.
I whimper in desperation, pleasure, and defeat as he pulls my head into his lap, piercing my lips with his throbbing cock. As I close my mouth around it to form as tight a seal as I can, I breathe in his musky scent, letting it chain me down at his feet, disassembling my resistance.
Yes, fuck, he says. Fucking finally. Show me you know who calls the shot here, girl. I'm your boss.
I moan around his dick, his words going straight to my pussy, stimulating it more than any sex ever could. I try to think of how Leah looks when deep-throating my strap-in, so I close my eyes, distending my facial features to look as attractive as possible, stretching my lips as they slide up and down on his shaft. I make sure to alternate closing my eyes in worship, and looking up at him with big, submissive, terrified eyes. The kind of girly look that pleads for a man's mercy, such as there is to be found. This is the very first blowjob Reinhardt is getting from his longtime crush, and I want him to enjoy every minute of it. Absurdly, there's barely any room in my mind for the consideration that it's my first blowjob, period, and that I certainly never dreamed I would be giving one. Much less enjoying it. But Reinhardt ensures my enjoyment with a stream of humiliating words.
A woman's mouth was never meant to be heard,
he says, throwing his head back in delight.
Just to be felt around a dick.
God, you've cock-teased me for years, you and your girlfriends, but that ends today. You're mine now. MMMPPPHHH.
I mumble in meek apologetic agreement around his cock. I feel so utterly cowed, so ultimately female, so domesticated. I'm imagining every girlfriend I've ever had, kneeling alongside me, waiting for the privilege of worshipping master with their lips. I wonder how many of them have been collared already. I hope they're being good, obedient dykes for their master like I am. I hope if any of them are still free, that they get collared soon. I'm being conditioned to think these vile thoughts, purely because they go straight to my cunt, and it's working, and the fact that it's working tells me I really am a dumb slut, that I really do deserve this. I ignore the soreness in my jaw, concentrating on my duty, on my future as his sex kitten, his domestic little pet. Is he going to move in with us? Is he going to break us up? Maybe I can convince him to let me stay with Leah, if I'm good enough for him. That's when Reinhardt suddenly snaps me out of my reverie, pulling out of my mouth. He's panting hard, sweating, his muscular chest rising and falling.
Get on the bed, slave, he says.
It's so simple a word, slave, but it makes me cream myself. That's what I am to him now. Our friendship is over, because I'm not good enough to be his equal. God, that's so hot. I get to my feet, struggling to keep my balance, but before I can approach the bed, he's thrown me on it, landing atop me with his body weight. He pins me down, one knee against my back, as he fumbles with my jeans, sliding them off. My underwear follows, and I know I'm presenting my defeated cunt to a domineering man, for the very first time. God, I can't believe how good it feels, being held down by a man like this. I can barely contain my anticipation as he pulls my hips upward, until I'm on all fours, my face down on the mattress under the palm of his open hand. I let out a startled mule as Reinhardt's fingers toy with my sex, giving my clit a few hesitant strokes, gauging my reaction. He lets out a satisfied chuckle when I start trying to hump his fingers.
Whoever designed this is a fucking genius, he says, and I have to agree.
God, the speed and totality of my breakdown is insane. I was a lesbian and a feminist literal days ago. No. Now I'm a submissive puddle of girly weakness, waiting for my master to finally claim me. I never understood how deep the link is between subjugation and femininity. But now I do, and I'll never look at men the same way again. Then, without warning, Reinhardt's hand closes in a fist around my hair, and pulls. As my upper body climbs in the air, he aligns his hips with mine, thrusting into me with all his strength. I gasp as he enters me, my back arching to meet his pull on my hair, my cunt clenching around his cock as it defiles me. There's no going back from this. I can't unsuck his cock or undo the fact that a man has fucked me. At last, the programming has won. I've been claimed as a man's slut. I'm sure something as simple as penetration isn't supposed to feel this good. But to my programming-addled brain, this is literally too much pleasure to handle. Lubricated and aroused like never before, I find myself babbling incoherently as I begin to enthusiastically bounce on Reinhardt's dick.
millions of years of evolution have sculpted your body to be a sex toy for men. Reinhardt says, his free hand exploring my thighs, my breasts, my neck while he pulls on my hair like a set of makeshift reins. The misogyny makes me break out in a series of guttural moans. I have plans for you and Leah. He continues, pistoning in and out of me, gaining ground inside me with every new thrust. She's so submissive it's barely any fun bossing her around. You, on the other hand, so willful and strong. I'll love breaking you. Master! I shout, the one coherent word I can manage as he literally fucks feminism and independence out of me. That's right, he says. Leah, she can continue to study. I might even let her look for a job after she gets a degree. Nothing too prestigious, of course, something more befitting her station, secretarial work, so she doesn't get uppity. I widen my eyes at the implication of what he's saying, and my mind thinks back to Frida, now reduced and vanquished, and Professor Watkins, and Cindy's disappointment when I let her know I'm not coming to class, ever again. You now, he continues, my cunt clenching harder around his cock. You, I have different plans for. And trust me, for what I have in mind, you certainly don't need a degree dash. I cut him off, his words drowned out by my desperate scream as I climax around him. The devastating shockwaves of my orgasm radiate outward from my sex, destroying all defense in their place until nothing is left of me except my submission and my pleasure. A cock has just taken me to orgasm. No, a man stripping me of my education has just taken me to orgasm. And it's nothing like any climax I've ever known. It's like there's a clit in my brain, like the programming has created whole new pleasure centers for Reinhardt to tease, torture, and eventually conquer. Remember, I'm your legal guardian now, he says, huffing and puffing behind me as I grind myself against his hips. I'll take away your bank accounts. And again, my scream cuts him off. The mere idea of surrendering my material, financial autonomy to a man is enough to hit my fragile female brain like a hammer on a pane of glass. I shout my servile orgasm for all the world to hear, wondering if Leah is touching herself to my unconditional surrender. I hope she is, the little slut. You're no longer a lesbian, Reinhardt says, tugging on my hair, making my back adhere to his chest as he bottoms out inside me. And you're no longer Leah's girlfriend. She's mine now, submissive and inferior, but a girlfriend nonetheless. You. He bites my neck, his free hand twisting my nipples, my shaking body held upwards only by his strong arms. You're a slave girl. My slave girl. I have so many fantasies I want to live out with you, and trust me, during so many years lusting after you, I've had the time to think of so many of them. I whimper and moan at his utter conquest of me, relishing his breath on my neck. I'm so sorry. I say, sniveling, groveling, begging. Following, and submitting, and falling. What for, slut? I'm sorry that I ever dared compete in the same job market as you. I say, my every muscle trembling with electricity. I'm sorry I always acted like I was your equal. I'm sorry I've refused you. I should have given myself over to you the moment I noticed you wanted me, master. Oh, you will be, Reinhardt says, slapping my rear, which threatens to send me over the edge again all by itself. Thankfully that can be rectified now. You're so grateful to the developers for this, aren't you? Oh God, he's really going to make me say it. I'm really going to have to thank them. I'm an addict looking for a fix. And so, I know no hesitation. I'm so grateful, I shout at the top of my lungs. I want to kiss their cocks in reverence. I'll write it all over my social media. I'll share my experience in catcher spaces. Thank you for letting me know that women aren't people, that I belong to master. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And then, for a third time, I orgasm. My brain short circuits as I experience a system crash, and it feels like I'm literally coming my brains out, growing dumber and simpler and more docile with every twitch and spasm of my broken body. That's fine. I won't be needing brains anymore. Reinhardt lets me go, and I collapse face first on the bed, winded and in shock. But I still mewl in pleasure when he lies right against my back, crushing me into the mattress with his weight. I know he hasn't come yet, and I don't know what supernatural endurance has allowed him to do that. But I know he'll have his dues, and that my work is not yet done. Tousling my hair, however, he keeps speaking into my ear. You remember I mentioned certain techniques to domesticate women? He says, his voice so deep, so commanding, so dominant. I nod meekly, whispering my answer like it's a half-remembered prayer. Wondrous and terrifying results. Yes, Reinhardt says, and I can hear the sadistic smile in his voice as he draws closer to my ear. Let me show you. Epilogue: A Fallen Woman. MMPPHH? I mutter. It's a soft call to get attention. My knees are starting to tingle, after all. Quiet, Leah says from above me, her eyes narrowing. And stay still. If I misapply the nail polish, we're starting over. In the same position. I mumble softly an apology, resigning myself to acting as her footstool for a little while longer. Unlike me, she gets to sit on the sofa, the beautiful soles of her feet pampered, soft, unblemished, adhering completely to my defeated face as she paints her toenails. A part of me really appreciates the many layers at play here, of course. By encouraging interfemale competition, catchers like Reinhardt can further the domestication of our gender. Too busy to fight over scraps of power that fall from their table, we keep one another down for their amusement. In my peculiar case, there's more to it than that, of course. When I was Leah's girlfriend, I used to utterly dominate her in bed. Making me her maid and waiting girl has utterly destroyed what sliver of independence and pride I could still hold, after Master first turned me straight. She was by far less academically gifted than me. So she gets to keep studying, and can look forward to a secretarial position somewhere down the line, while I have to stay at home, cooking and cleaning. The reversal is obvious. I was the one more out of line with the new order, dreaming above my station. Leah submitted immediately, while I resisted. That's why I need to be brought down harder. My humiliation-addicted brain doesn't mind that at all. There's more, of course, there's always more. Reinhardt picks what Leah is allowed to wear, but at least she gets some selection of skirts and dresses, and even jeans on the occasions when he's feeling generous. My closet consists of nothing but skimpy, scandalous French-made uniforms. As I've come to learn, it was a big kink for Master, so of course I'm expected to submit to it in full. And I can't certainly say it doesn't match my role. A cleaning girl and a sex slave. That's what I have become, and what I am destined to be under Master's generous guidance. There is one more major difference between Leah and I. She is allowed to speak. I don't just muffle beneath her soles because her naked heels press harshly down against my lips. I do it because Master has taken away my ability to speak without getting prompting and or permission from a man. That is a humiliation so devastating that even thinking about it is enough to bring me close to the edge of climax. What is a woman without her voice? Without the ability to express her opinions and feelings, or even just to verbally acknowledge orders. Just a set of holes, that's what. And to my domesticated mind, it seems only fitting. I look up at Leah with big, pleading eyes, but I know they won't move her. She takes some pleasure out of our reversal, but even if she didn't, she would carry it out to perfection. This is Master's will, after all. Done! She says at last, removing her feet from my face and lowering them to the ground. She cocks her head, waiting for me to perform due reverence, which I immediately do. I prostrate myself before my ex-girlfriend, blowing her nails dry. Then I start placing worshipful kisses all along her soles, arches, heels, and toes. She's kind enough to lift each foot in turn to allow me to reach the soles with my conquered lips. I even gently fellate her big toes when I'm done, a gesture that makes her rub her thighs in pleasure, as always. That's a good doggy, she says, ruffling my hair. And just in time, too. It's 5 o'clock, and you know what that means. Run along to Master, come on. GNNNHH. I mumble in appreciation and arousal. Leah is used to my nonverbal communication by now, and dismisses me with a flick of her hand. I crawl on all fours out the room, and only once in the hallway am I allowed to stand up. I compose myself as best I can, making sure I look perfect for Master, before marching down the hallway. Yes, there are many differences between Leah and I, but in one thing, we are the same. We are both collared women, our Master's property, to do with as he sees fit. We've both had to abandon our life plans, and accept whatever terms he saw fit to impose upon us. Just like the rest of womankind, whose enslavement deepens with every passing day. In the future, I tell myself, feminism and the fight for equality will be remembered as a barely detectable blip in history. A small flicker of light that burned for a very short time, then faded, and died. I don't know if getting to live that transition in person is a blessing, or a curse. By the time I make my way to Master's study, which used to be mine, of course I drop to the ground again, crawling in on all fours. He looks up from his laptop, smiling at me. You're punctual, fuck puppet. He says. Get to work, Dyke. MMPPHH. I mumble wordlessly. He clocks off work at this time, and always likes to end the day with a nice blowjob, so I do as I am bid, and slide under his desk. We do this every afternoon, with me eagerly tasting his precum while he holds my head, treating my face like it's little more than masturbatory aid for him. I swallow most of the time, but sometimes he'll finish on my face, and order me to leave his cum to dry for the rest of the evening, marking me as his property, with his scent and with his seed. Even before the event, a man face-fucking a woman would sometimes forget that she was a person, or so Master has told me once. But now, whenever he masturbates himself with my lips, it's different. Now I'm the one who remembers that I'm not a person. If I ever was, the payload put an end to that for good. Now I'm just a warm receptacle for cum, my mouth existing to perform suction around cock. To be felt, rather than heard. It's part of who I am, of my feminine biology. Even if it wasn't, the fact that I was so pliable to the programming speaks for itself. The simple truth is that women are easy to tame, and that men have a sixth sense for putting them in their place. I used to think this was predatory behavior, but now I understand this is just what men do, in the same way that cats will just toy with mice and lizard that trespass in an apartment. It's in their nature to be predators, and it's in our nature to be prey. I begin to gag and glurk as Master breaches the entrance to my throat. My gag reflex has been trained out of me, but even so, as his hand palms down on my head and his cock tames my throat, my eyes begin to water. He starts truly fucking my face, then, enjoying the gluck 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 sounds. I'm sure they're more interesting than anything I could possibly have to say. As always, the clit in my brain throbs at the utter feminine meekness I display for him, and I quietly climax around his cock. It's nowhere near as strong as the first time, of course, but that doesn't worry me. When I really need to re-experience the thrill, there's always more parts of my life I can surrender to him. More fellow women I can betray. More dehumanizing humiliations I can cook up for myself. At last, Master's cock quivers inside my mouth, and that's enough to make me squeal with pure womanly joy. He pulls back just enough to let me breathe, and then the first rope of his cum hits the back of my mouth. I do my best to swallow, drooling around his cock, rope after rope painting my mouth white, marking his territory. As the last dribble of his cum is deposited atop my tongue, I withdraw my lips with a final suction, and loudly gulp it all down. I suckle and clean at Master's softening cock, and follow him as he rolls the chair slightly away from his desk just far back enough that he can look down at me, cleaning his cock. He studies my eyes, as if looking for something.
There's no dignity left in you, he says at last.
Is there?
MMPPHH.
I reply, shaking my head around his cock.
Just as I thought, he says, withdrawing from me.
Before I can offer him tissue, however, his hand lands atop my head again, pushing me down. When I've descended out of his reach, his booted foot lifts in the air. The flat sole of his boot settles firmly against my neck, and then he pushes, pinning me to the floor.
Stay there, he says, but it's a redundant order.
The mental image of it all me splayed on the floor, broken and defeated, with his boot literally planted on my neck, is enough to make me quietly climax again. It's a tiny, subdued orgasm this time, but I welcome it nonetheless. As his sole moves away from my neck, adhering to my cheek, I relax and let it crush my face against the ground. It feels like heaven. A strange acceptance washes over me, and for the first time since the event, I realize I am fully at peace with what happened. Nothing of the old Audrey is left, nothing of her resistance, anyway. I let out a little, submissive oh, sighing out in relaxation and defeat, the slackening of all resistance. My facial features distend, and my body goes limp and slumps while Reinhard poses with me as a hunter would with his slain prey. And I realize, with a tingle of pleasure, that this is a perfect metaphor for the state of the world right now. Me, a former lesbian and feminist, not even on her knees anymore, but acting as a footstool for her male conqueror, while he sits at the desk where he works and wins bread for the household, all of this, having just obediently swallowed his cum. It could become a painting, encapsulating every minor nuance of the modern world. It's worth more than 1,000 words, it's perfect. Some people might fool themselves that this is temporary, that the payload is going to get rolled back eventually, but I know that Cindy was right. I know that this single, magnificent image represents everything, the past, the present, and the future. It's strange to think that I actually used to read books and form opinions on them, before the event. But I'm kind of glad that I did, because now, a distant quote from Orwell comes back to my mind, unbidden. With a suitable alteration, it perfectly describes the speed and depth of the fall of women. The future is man's boot, pressing down on woman's face. Forever. The dawn of a new order. Fall of women. Christmas special. 1. Losing composure. Today, being a woman is like being at war. There are some events that challenge your entire self-perception, the image of you that's projected into your own mind. Your mettle is put to the test, hold fast, or fall. It may be artificial, insidious, evil, but that's what the payload's been for all women, myself included. I've always fancied myself the strong, fearless businesswoman. But the reality of spending every day with this curse, for months, has taught me this: I'm no frontline soldier. Fittingly, given the metaphor, I bunkered myself in at home. That's a bit humiliating, I suppose. I, Celeste Short, youngest female executive in the industry, have become so scared of my own shadow that I only leave my house when strictly necessary. That's a defeat, right there, make no mistake about it. I may not have given into a collar yet, but I've let men take the outside world from me. From inside the safety of my cocoon, I've watched the outside world reeling, women's rights retreating, our independence being chipped away day after day. Across multiple countries, female lawmakers have had to give up their seats. After all, what if a hostile actor collared them, and induced them to treason? For similar reasons, only men have voted in the subsequent by-elections. Our legal liability has been taken away, but with it, has gone our very emancipation. Temporary. It's temporary, only until the payload is undone. And yet I live in fear of what's going to be taken from us next. By themselves, my hands travel to my throat, caressing the smooth skin. My neck is bare, and collar-free. No matter how many times my brain is bombarded with traitorous images, visions I would have never before considered hot in my life. Visions of wiry fingers, knees hitting the floor, lips on the tip of a man's shoe, performing due reverence to the half of humanity that's always been, and always will be in charge. Damn it. I snap myself out of the reverie, willing every fiber of my being to stay with me. I've made it this far. It's been months now, since the world turned upside down. Surely it won't be much longer before a solution is found. I can't believe we're actually about to have our very first Christmas in this new nightmare world, but I very much hope it will be the last. Immediately after the payload upended the world, I shifted to permanent work from home, and thankfully, no one in the company has stood in my way. I know many other women worldwide haven't been as fortunate as me. Between my generous wages, deliveries, and the equipment in my home office, I've been able to barricade myself against the tidal wave of male power. But, as I stare in stupefaction and horror at my computer screen, I tell myself that this peace was always going to only be temporary. That the outside world wouldn't stay outside forever. That eventually, it would find its way in. And it has. Oh my, it has. I'm being summoned back to the office. In person. For, or so the work email states, a bureaucratic matter of utmost urgency. I don't know what it could be, and for a second I consider whether this may be a mistake, but... I gulp, shaking my head. How matter of fact, this email is. It asks me to please attend a meeting in person, due to unspecified bureaucratic requirements, and concludes with an invitation to the office Christmas party, and a wish to have happy holidays. A Christmas party. In the middle of the single biggest global violation of human rights in decades. You can tell this email was written by a man. You can always tell. Only they could sound so calm and collected about all of this. Only they would somehow find it fitting to throw in a mention of the corporate Christmas party in a situation like this. As if any uncollared woman would ever risk attending something like that. But you can trust men to act like nothing's changed, and everything's under control. Because they're rational, the payload supplies, of course. They have a solution for everything. They don't lose control to their hormones and their hysterical emotions, not like silly little girls, not like you. I dig my nails so deep in my palms that I'm basically stabbing myself. It works. It's a small thing, but associating pain with the payload's programming is one of the few tips that actually seem to work keeping it at bay. It's still a struggle, every day, and that's at home, without the sensory bombardment of the outside world, but it's better than nothing. At last, I find the strength to get away from my computer and start my daily routine. Except it isn't daily anymore, hasn't been since the event. With a gulp, I realize that things are different now. It's not just simple as picking a professional attire I like and sticking with it. Not anymore. I go for the most gender-neutral clothing I can find, conservative dark pants and flats, a shirt and jacket. And then, I wrap a thick scarf around my neck for good measure. Every woman has known the ogling of men at some point or other in her life, but the event truly has given us all a whole new creepy experience, the way the eyes of a few men in every crowd will linger on your neck, noticing the absence of a collar, imagining how well one would fit you, how good you'd look like on your knees. I rally myself, rejecting the mental image. I muster what courage I can, and leave the safety of my home, stepping out, into the open. The first thing that hits me, alongside the cold wind, is Christmas music coming out of a nearby store. War is over, if you want it. Not for us, it isn't, I think to myself with a shake of my head. Women's war has just begun, and peace looks farther than it ever has in my life. Then, it occurs to me that I truly am outside. The entire world is a danger space where any man, at any time, might try his hand at overwhelming my independence and likely win. I'm fair game. I'm not safe. In a frantic second, dozens of guides and resources for women in the post-payload world surface back to my mind. I scan the street, and immediately find what I'm looking for: a group of women, headed for the same subway station I used to go to work. It's safer to travel in groups. It reduces the odds that a man will initiate a social interaction that might, or might not involve a hostile takeover. Fortunately for me, most men seem quite cooperative. I mean, it makes sense in a way, of course, it's just, emotionally, it's still a surprise and a relief. They give us a wide berth when noticing us. When we get down to the subway, the mindless mingling of the pre-payload world is largely forgotten. Us women group to one side of the platform, seeking to occupy a carriage in its entirety. We look like we're under siege, but it works. While the men are more scattered than we are, they do generally converge towards the far end of the platform. A few assholes linger on our side, of course, shooting us looks that are supposed to be casual and nonchalant, but are nothing but. I wrap my scarf even harder around my neck, sticking my hands inside the pockets of my coat. At last, the train arrives, and my carriage does indeed have a near-total female occupancy, but not total. That's unavoidable, of course. Some of the men stand to give up their seat, doing their best to look embarrassed and inconspicuous. But again, a few stay arrogantly seated, more or less openly ogling and leering. I can feel eyes on me, wondering what's underneath my scarf. A collar? A bare neck? In a way, either prospect is probably enough to stir something in their pants, which makes me shiver. I'm not allowed to just exist. To them, I'm either own property, or unclaimed property. And that's all I'll ever be. The payload tries to convince me that's hot. Worse, that it's proper. That millions of years of evolution have sculpted every inch of my body to be alluring to a man, and frankly, the intellect attached to it is just an accessory. I close my eyes, despairing. This better be the last time I get called in until the whole thing is resolved. I'm not sure I could bear another trip like this. I feel. Well, I suppose it makes sense, given the metaphors. And yet somehow, the verbalization of my emotions catches even me by surprise. I feel like a soldier, marching to war. When I step across the threshold of the company office building, I feel like I'm entering the lion's den. My grim mood is in sharp contrast with the chirpy voice greeting me at the entrance.
Welcome back, ma'am,
Shannon, the receptionist says. I turn to face her, blinking in mild confusion at the jarring mirth in her tone. She smiles radiantly at me, her red hair tied back into a ponytail, further emphasizing her neck and. Oh God. Just seeing the collar firmly clinched around her neck makes me weak in the knees. I almost lose my footing, leaning against her receptionist's desk for balance.
Hi Shannon,
I say at last, embarrassed at the heavy, almost panting quality of my breathing.
You okay?
Super, she says, flashing me an enormous smile. Like she hasn't lost her freedom to a man. Like she isn't wearing his collar like a good little bitch, a loyal servant of the new order, a woman defeated and fallen, claimed and reduced against her will, molded and reshaped, taken. If I continue this line of thought, I won't make it past the lobby. Nails dig into my palms. Flashes of pain bring me back to the world as it truly is ugly, drab, and hostile to my gender. With a frustrated groan, I assess my surroundings. I look around at the open floor space Shannon shares the ground floor with the secretarial pool. I note with detachment that the formerly mixed gender pool in question now looks overwhelmingly staffed by women. I look back to Shannon, who's still smiling, like a perfectly radiant vision of feminine compliance. I can't help but think of all the times a man has told a woman to just smile more because it makes us look prettier. I can't help but think of the ambitious, driven person she was, forced into a receptionist role by circumstances, she very much didn't want her career to end there. Now, she looks like a poster girl for the new order.
Shannon, if I may.
I say, hesitating as I throw a meaningful glance towards her collar.
Who?
Oh. She says, tittering, shielding her mouth with her hand, affecting modesty. It's impossible to miss the subtle rubbing of her thighs as she does it, the way she angles herself, revealing just an inch more of her nylon thigh. She notices my gaze and smiles.
Mr. Sharp himself. Can you believe how lucky I am? You jealous?
I gulp, a sense of dread knotting my stomach. Lucky is not exactly the word I'd use. Sharp is the biggest misogynist in the company, and maybe most importantly, he's, well, a bitter rival of mine. My nemesis. He's technically my subordinate. He lost out to me in the latest round of promotions, and has never forgiven me for it. But professional propriety has forced him to go along with it. Of course, that was before. Now men don't answer to us, not anymore. I can't imagine what horror being owned by him must be like, no matter how many brainwashed smiles Shannon throws my way. I shake my head.
I'll go up, I have a meeting.
Of course. Shannon says, giggling. We'll be seeing lots of each other soon anyway.
I'm about to have so much company down here.
I stop dead in my tracks, and almost ask what she means, but I'm on the edge of panic as is, and I don't want to be in this building any longer than I have to. Not one moment longer. I'll get this meeting done with, and then flee home and hopefully not leave again until it is safe to do so. Until this whole nightmare is undone. I ride the elevator to the 16th floor, and enter the conference room. And I instantly do a double take. Every seat at the large, oaken conference table is occupied. By men.
Why all men?
Where are the other women executives? And then, as my eyes scan the length and width of the table, an even worse realization washes over me. There's no seat for me. I'm the sole woman in the room, forced to stand, confronted by an army of men in power suits, staring me down. It is an intimidating, awe-inspiring, terrifying display, and the payload gets to work trying to disassemble my mind, to convince that these men are sitting in judgment of me, even if most are technically my subordinates. That this sense of impending judgment is how I should feel every time a man contemplates me. That the anxiety to not measure up should stir me to become a better, meeker, more feminine and obedient version of myself. That I deserve to have a man's shoe firmly planted on my neck, literally brought to heel as he finally ends my independence and domesticates me. Pain brings me back to earth. I can't let them see my weakness. I can't begin to swoon in place, not here, not now. No matter how slick my sex is getting. Every male executive in the company has gathered here, and the sheer impact of maleness is too much for my female brain to process without unraveling. In a slap of clarity, I realize that's not true, that they're not actually sitting in judgment of me. Most of the men here don't look haughty and superior. They scrupulously avoid my gaze, their cheeks colored by what might be embarrassment, or even shame. Even my boss, CEO Frank Wolf, seems bizarrely focused on a stack of paper in front of him. Pretty much the only smiles in the room come from two executives. One is Lance Fowler, a confident ladder climber 10 years my junior, and a recently minted junior exec. He looks standard in a dystopian way, the average ambitious, ruthless young white-collar predator, come off an assembly line of business-oriented jocks just like him. He's lean, clean-shaven, and looks completely heartless. He's not a misogynist, or a professional ogler, like some of his colleagues. I genuinely feel he's just very, self-absorbed. And ambitious, of course. That above all. He gives me a small, polite smile. I can see that there's nothing in that smile. It doesn't reach his eyes. And you know what? In this world, that suits me just fine. Give me a man's indifference any day. Make me bloody invisible to them. The other smile, of course, comes from my nemesis. Sharp is heavyset, going bald and portly, his breath reeking of cigar smoke. He's a much more outspoken kind of misogynist, and is now looking at me with a hungry expression. His eyes linger on my neck, and I'm glad I haven't taken my scarf off. At last, CEO Wolf clears his throat. Still unable to meet my gaze, he starts reciting a droll speech, like he's gone over the words 1,000 times in his head.
I'm sorry, Celeste, he says. As you know, women have no legal personality now.
It takes me a heartbeat to understand where this is going. But when I do, I experience a moment of jarring dissociation, like I'm outside my own body. Everyone said I had a non-trivial chance of succeeding Wolf as CEO someday. And now his words flow freely in my ears, as I see all my hard work being destroyed. The sleepless nights studying, the corporate politics, the failed relationships because I always put work first. All just to get here. To this moment. Can't have someone who could potentially get collared access critical files, financial information, you understand, right? I swoon in place, feeling more and more like I'm about to faint. Return to your old position as soon as the law changes. My hands are tied, a matter of liability. Selected for you the highest role I could think of that didn't expose us to any legal risks. I don't catch half of what Wolf is saying, the panic attack rising within me too loud, too blinding, drowning out most of his speech. Even so, I find myself nodding, stupefied, unable to form coherent words. Demoted to head secretary. A jolt of electricity goes through me at that, and I hate how my cunt pulses when he says that singular, cursed word. The payload immediately latches upon it, cramming it into my thoughts, letting it poison every element of my self-perception. Demoted. The nail digging doesn't help. Not this time, and it's because of that singular word.
It's the most offensive, outrageous, devastating, soul-crushingly hot word I've ever heard in my life. As my vision begins to swim, and I find myself bending over and dropping to the floor in shock, all I see is the faces of Lance and Sharp, superior and otherworldly, triumphant and ultimately male, as they look down at me. Smiling. Grinning. Winning.
2. Losing control. Secretaries don't work from home. It's a slow, but inescapable realization. You'd think that the utter and flippant destruction of my career, of my professional hopes and dreams, so many years of hard work, would be impossible to top. But no, it does get worse, because secretaries don't work from home. My safety has been taken away from me. Wittingly or no, the company has placed me in a position where I need to be at the office in person, every day. That means I need to commute, every day. Always traveling with groups of women, so we can march into coffee shops together, or occupy train carriages as far as we can. Seeking ephemeral safety in numbers. I tried to tell myself that the walls aren't closing in on me, that most men are absolutely supportive of our plight, even after so many months of the payload slowly eroding our independence. Unfortunately, what I can't chase out of my mind is a singular, chilling thought. I need to be lucky every time I commute to and from the office. A would-be predator only needs to be lucky once. And then there's the office itself, which is by now a terrifyingly heady concoction of humiliation, rage, fear, and arousal. I'm overstimulated and oversexed every damn minute of the workday. The entire situation looks engineered to provide ammunition to the payload. I oversee a group of women who used to occupy the most varied positions in the company. Jen, who was head of legal. Francesca, who's been around the world at a dozen different headquarters for the company, until she made it to the board of directors. Jasmine, who used to oversee logistics. Now, they all dress in secretarial nylons and skirts. Worse, their attitudes have changed. They simper and bow, answer in meek tones and bow their heads docilely at every request that comes from a man. Periodically, when the payload seizes them, their eyes go glassy and vacant until they snap back to reality, looking flustered, ashamed, and terrified, but also aroused. In short, looking just like me. These women used to be in charge of entire departments. The most they can be in charge of now is photocopying. They fetch coffee for their former subordinates, and it's impossible to ignore how the collared ones get called into a man's office near closing time, with the doors being conspicuously locked. Is this what the corporate world looks like now? This, parody straight out of a porn shoot, with strong women reduced to a slutty secretarial or PA role? My life is like the cruel joke of an easily amused god. I stand guard over a kingdom of defeated femininity, a veritable army of women who have been demoted, cowed into submission, and made lesser by their new male overlords. Maybe that's just how work is going to be from now on. Are we going to have a blowjob rota for the secretaries? Will I read my name, penciled in pretty handwriting, next to a time slot where I'm supposed to drop to my knees, crawl under a man's desk, and show him with my mouth just what kind of an asset a competent businesswoman can be to the office? I squeeze my thighs in desperate arousal at the mere thought that this is the future. That these and more will be the terms imposed upon us if we lose this war. When we lose this war. Some of the women in the office are sporting collars. More now than a week ago. I wonder how many were collared here by their very colleagues, how many by friends they thought they could trust, how many by strangers on the way to work. I could ask, but my fight against the payload is desperate as it is. Instead, I keep quiet and immerse myself in the work, such as it is. I've never done anything even remotely secretarial, but at least as head secretary, I have a nominal organizational role that I can try and acclimate myself with. But in truth, I mostly spend the workdays obsessing over what I've lost. The money's not the same, of course. To put it mildly, I have enough savings that I can get comfortably by for a long time, especially because I own my house, but the meager sum of my new paycheck reminds me just how much my stocks have fallen in this place. In this world. My office is gone, claimed by Sharp, of course, who immediately seized my former position, to his endless glee. It's unclear who will occupy the slot he's vacated in turn, and a decision will be made in due time, but of course it will be a man. In the payload's world, our place is on our knees literally, and metaphorically. I suppose that's where a war's loser belongs. In exchange for giving up my prized office, I've gotten a cubicle. I refuse to personalize it, I can't. My mind still won't accept that this demotion is real, that it's going to stick. And in a sense of misguided confidence proves the origin of my downfall. At lunch, one day, I confide in Shannon. I'm mulling over a plan, I tell her. I'm doing it because I refuse to go down quietly, to let a man's shoe press down against my throat, silencing my objections until I can only whimper as a way to beg for breathing. I'm going to resign, rather than accept this. I really do have enough money saved that I could ride this out, especially if I'm a little careful. Even so, I don't plan to stay at home forever. The payload will be undone eventually, and when it does, I need to be in a position to capitalize on it. What if it takes 5 years? How can I rebuild a career with 5 years of unemployment behind me? No, I'll start looking for another job. I'm liable to run into the same issues. After all, women no longer have legal personality, a thought which makes my traitorous cunt begin to lubricate. But no matter how long the odds are, I have to try something. A workplace even slightly less demeaning than this. One without Sharp in it, though I don't say that out loud. I'm not asking for the moon, I know the world has changed. All I'm asking for is stable ground beneath me, so I can lay the foundations for a better future, once things get back to normal. I share all this with Shannon in an almost manic phase,
the adrenaline from feeling in control again pumping through my veins. I'm not sure what a collared woman will think of all this talk of career and independence, but she notes my description with uncharacteristically muted interest, and then changes the topic. The office Christmas party is 2 days away, she reminds me. She can't wait to dress as sexy Santa. Very work appropriate, she says, to my silent bewilderment. In retrospect, that should have raised my suspicions, but like I said, I'm no soldier. I wasn't cut out for fighting, scheming, and plotting. My rise through the corporate ranks was never predicated on elbow rubbing and backroom maneuvering. I always believed that if I was good at my job, really good, then I'd make myself near indispensable, and I wouldn't have to worry about the politics. Too much. The next day, I'm summoned into my, or rather, Sharp's office. It's an experience I can hardly put into words. Seeing the bastard sit behind my own desk, his portly ass resting in my chair, makes my hands ball into fists. I don't know what's more awful, the humiliation, the fury, or the payload, urging me to drop to my knees, crawl beneath the desk, and offer him my unconditional surrender in a way befitting my womanly status, recognizing that the fight is over, the job is his now, and so am I, that he's won. Nails dig into my flesh. I step back from the brink, and as clarity returns and brings the world into focus, I realize something I'd missed in my submissive reverie. We're not alone in the office. I almost didn't notice her, but Shannon is sitting in a corner of the office, swiveling in a chair, one nylon leg elegantly draped over the other. My eyes linger on the way her calf looks when pressed against her other knee. On the way she smirks at me with something that looks like victory. I remember our conversation from yesterday, and recall our conversation from yesterday. Even worse, I recall something I read once, as part of my efforts to prepare for the brave new world we live in. Yes, women are safer in groups, and yes, there's some way to deter dangerous social interactions in numbers, but collared women are a safety hazard, and not just because their owners might order them to do just about anything. It's actually much worse than that. After you surrender, the payload uses addiction to train you, program you. It makes victims go to more and more extreme lengths to re-experience the original thrill. Like, say, betraying uncollared women to a man. Maybe uncollared women who are too unwise and stupid to shut up about their plans to leave the company. For example. Let me clarify something. Sharp says as I curse my dumb, sorry self. You try to resign, I will do everything in my power to stall it, to slow you down. I will call back every favor I'm owed, and make sure you're fired in disgrace instead. I can blacklist you, and you know it. You'll never find another job again. BB but. I ask, tears welling in my eyes, making me feel like a stupid little girl in the presence of this man I once presumed to call my rival. My subordinate even. The man who's now blackmailing me into staying here. And why? That's what I asked him, what I want to know. Why? You've got the promotion you wanted, Jay, just let me go and live my life. There's something I want even more than this chair. Sharp says, and the way his eyes linger on my neck leave no doubt as to what he means. And I plan to get it. In a way, I should have seen it coming. What better way to really put me in my place? To get back at me forever challenging him? The horror must be apparent on my face, because he leans back in his chair, waving his hand. Don't look so shocked, Celeste. He says, leering at me. Every hot-blooded male in this office has thought about fucking you at least once, and you know it. Way I see it, you only leapfrogged me because of all that affirmative action silliness. Well, that's over now, and I plan to get my dues. That makes my insides twist in horror, and it sends a hot, searing jolt of traitorous arousal, lancing through every fiber of my being. If you get yourself collared by a friend or someone outside this company, I'll end you. If you try to resign, I'll end you. Sure, you could take the character assassination I'm planning on you, I suppose, but I know you, Celeste. We've sparred too long for me not to know you. I gulp, feeling pinned in place by his words, a man's words, spoken while a man's eyes reads me like an open book. I'm outmatched in this fight, and I always have been. The payload is telling me that he deserves to win, and it's so hard to ignore it. Work is everything for you, he says. And life without it is meaningless to you. And that's why you'll yield to my blackmail. You'll stay right here, and try to salvage something out of the ruins of your career, try to resist me, until you no longer can. Then, at last, this little feud of ours will end, and the spoils will go to the rightful winner. The sheer arrogance, toxic entitlement, authority in his voice takes my breath away. Staying here, in this office, is very, very dangerous. I take a faltering step back, but that's when Shannon suddenly stands to her feet, sauntering towards me with a sultry look on her face. I look down, blushing in embarrassment, suddenly aware that she's taller than me. I never noticed before, but somehow, it seems important now. Really, I'm most displeased. Sharp says. We've done you a favor by retaining you. I even insisted that we keep you on as a secretary. For entirely unselfish reasons, of course. His grin stretches even wider. And this is how you repay us? JJ, just let me go. I say, stuttering, fully aware of what a self-admission of defeat and impotence that is. Please. Nobody's physically stopping me from rushing the door, but it's like I'm in a dream, trying to move underwater. My body is sluggish, slow to respond, fighting the payload every inch of the way, trying to ignore the suggestion that I should just descend to my knees. I really do have favors to call back. Sharp says, his eyes drilling into mine. I've called one now, in fact. I think the secretarial pool could use a fresh leadership. Of course, I'm afraid that does mean we're going to have to demote you. Again. There's that word once more. It strikes the very center of my being like a gong, the sound rippling outward, tickling my overstimulated feminine brain, my needy sex, making my thighs quiver as I struggle to stand up. Demoted. Has there ever been a more beautiful word, one more closely linked to weakness, inferiority, and womanhood? Your cubicle is mine now, Shannon says, drawing close to me, pushing me against the wall. I know there is nothing properly sapphic in her display. It isn't for her or my entertainment. It's for the male audience. It's her master she's trying to impress, her sudden lesbianism nothing more than a performance to stir his arousal. And yet my hips buck, trying to draw her in between my thighs. Her lips brush mine as she keeps whispering, just loud enough for him to hear. You better clean it well, girl, says this person who's 15 years my junior, who never even finished university, and who is now my superior. Yes, ma'am, I say, and at that, Shannon purrs, nibbling at my ear. That's not enough, she says. Thank me properly. Make him see. Her hands push me to my knees. I find myself bowing, forehead pressing to the floor, on all fours, panting like a dog or a worshipper. The payload lets loose with a stream of fever dreams, visions of a world where men get fed up with us, and our entire gender is finally brought under control. Visions where each sigh of our parted lips, each movement of our thighs, each bated breath as a man's hand clasps our throat, is programmed for perfect, unfailing eroticism. A world with a clear division of tasks, between those who rule and those who serve. A better world. With visions of man's empire pounding women into the dust, I find myself kissing Shannon's shoes and feet, regretting that she isn't a man and I can't whisper the words the payload whispers into my ear. Every woman knows them by heart now, our secret prayer. I consider myself owned. I know my old rival is relaxing back in his chair, listening to the sounds of his vanquished foe kissing another girl's shoes. He's taken away my job, my ability to resign, and now, what else will he take? What do I hope he will take? Look at me. I'm pathetic. I deserve to be stepped on. Shannon betrayed me, and how am I rewarding her? By lavishing her shoes with worshipful kisses. That's not something you can just recover from. I know the shape, texture, and taste of a woman's shoes now. I know how glossy the surface looks after each smooch I leave upon it. I know what it's like to stare at Shannon from down here, this girl who is my junior, prettier than me, who's just usurped me to feel the thrill of her submission to a master who hates me. If even this is so humbling, how much more terrifying would it be to look up at a man? Tenfold. Like being in the blinding orbit of a star. It occurs to me just how colorable I am in this position. Just how much like the ritual all of this looks, and I know it's only the beginning. I will have to work under this girl, with her master looming in the shadows, pulling all her strings. Shannon will be a brutal governess, ever loyal to Sharp. I can see it so vividly in my mind's eye, how she'll make it clear she intends to remold all us former female executives into good, obedient secretaries and PAs for the men, while no doubt taking her delight in bossing around women who used to make 10 times her salary. She will expose me to Sharp as much as she can, until I just can't take it anymore. Even if I don't fall now, eventually I will. And the misogynist bastard who hates me will finally get to clinch a collar around my neck and call me his. And that's so wrong and so hot that I almost want to give in, stop fighting. And that's when the old habit kicks in, just as Sharp begins to rise to his feet. Shannon, ever the obedient pet at the beck and call of men, immediately pivots to him, ready to attend to his needs. But out of pure instinct, my nails dig deep into my palms, so much that I have to bite my lips not to shout. For only a second, the whispers of the payload recede. It lasts a heartbeat, but it's all I need. Fueled only by adrenaline, I rise to my knees in one swift motion, and launch myself at the door. There's no stopping, not here, not now. I don't care about work, and its rules just like work doesn't care about my well-being and safety. I gather my things in a rush, and flee home as far as I can. I don't even change into something more comfortable. I just throw myself in bed, crying my heart out, sobbing at how close I came to losing everything to the worst person I've ever known. And to my horror, I find my hand wandering down between my thighs at the thought. God, why is it so easy to eroticize the fear of losing everything? Of letting one's life burn, consumed in the hungry flame of the payload? Yielding to the need, and letting it rule me? Destroy me? I spend the night sleeping restlessly, disturbed by half-formed dreams of male hands and fastened collars. I call in sick at work, feeling like a mole rat, burrowing for warmth and safety under my blankets. I never want to go out there. I can't take this anymore. What hope is there for salvation, if we women are made to betray one another just for the gratification induced by the payload? If we fight over scraps and crumbs, deliberately let to drop from the men's table? I know the answer in my heart, no hope at all. I cry to it, touch myself to it, gasp softly to it. It's over. They have won. Unless. That's when I sit up suddenly, my eyes wide as an idea begins to form. So far, every defense I've tried to put up against the new order has failed. Hiding didn't help, my career was taken away from me like candy from a baby, and one brush with Sharp was nearly enough to drag me into the abyss. Even confiding in a fellow woman only led to my betrayal. But maybe, just maybe, there's still one more card I have to play. 3. Losing freedom. I have a plan. It's not much of a plan. In a way, I suppose you could argue it isn't a plan at all, but... Well, the truth is, I am way too familiar with the psychology of abuse to not see it for what it is. When something truly traumatic happens to you, when you feel like a passive victim of life's events, you will do something, anything, to retain control. Even if it's stupid, or ineffectual. You do it because you have agency. Because doing something is still better than not fighting back. You do it to prove that you are not a slave. Which is where we get to the ironic part. The terms of Sharp's game are clear. The word of a woman is worth nothing today, and I'm incapable of standing up to his threats. I can't choose my employer, and I can't try to sneak out by asking a friend from a nominal collaring. But maybe that doesn't exactly mean I can't choose who collars me. Choose my owner. It simply means I need to be owned by someone strong enough to stand up to Sharp. I've considered many names, all from inside the company, as they have to be if I want to retain a defensive perimeter in the office. Wolf, maybe, but it's clear he'd never accept me. And even if he did, he's old and on the way out. I need someone who's ultimately not that interested in me, but who has no qualms about shackling a woman with a collar. Someone who's willing to go toe-to-toe with Sharp and defend his turf. It's such a meager victory. It doesn't feel like a victory at all. How pathetic is it when the only way you can enforce boundaries is to surrender them to another man? Like you're a thing who needs to be owned to be safe. Which, the payload helpfully supplies, is exactly what I'm supposed to be. I shake my head. Everything I've done so far has been to delay the inevitable, waiting for a miracle fix, or a cure or something. But I could only do it thanks to my relative isolation. Now, I have to commute every day, spend 8 hours being made into Shannon's literal and metaphorical footstool, and try to keep my composure, as Sharp's eyes drill straight into mine. I won't last. I know it in my bones. Shannon's betrayal was the straw that broke the camel's back, stripping me of all hope that I can find succor from anyone in that building. From any fellow woman in this world. And that is why, ultimately, I have a plan. And so, as the door before me opens, I step into Lance Fowler's home, and into the unknown. Lance Fowler fancies himself a man of refined tastes. His study looks like something from a different era, with plushy chairs and exquisite wooden furniture that wouldn't look out of place in a British admiral's office. He swirls whiskey in a glass as he considers me, each movement carried out with technocratic precision, the same way he delivers his chirpy reports and well-documented analyses. He is one to truly believe that excellence will carry him far in the corporate world. A bit like I used to, except I never gave off such obvious vibes of being calculating and ruthless. Before the payload, I would have laughed. Now, the mere idea of laughing at a man seems inconceivable to me, and that makes me feel incredibly small. How do you challenge power, when mockery and satire are taken away from you? Celeste, he says, affecting the cool, rational demeanor he so likes to project. I won't lie, yours is an alluring proposal. I certainly appreciate the kind of deal you're trying to strike. I do have a question, though. Why me? Why him indeed? I could always ask a friend, beg them, push them through their refusals, explain it's for my safety, but that wouldn't protect me at work. I don't know if collarings can be undone, or transferred, but I'm sure Sharp would find a way. Hell, with Shannon as my direct superior, I would eventually crumble and do what Sharp says, even if he doesn't collar me. I need someone to keep me safe at work. A guardian angel. Someone to protect me. And that means, a man. Not just any man, though. I need someone who's willing to stand up to Sharp, ambitious, confident, but also who isn't as much of a raving misogynist. And I need this to happen fast. You're not like others. I say, my voice so mousy and small. By that, of course, I mean that he's always been completely indifferent to me. Even when I was his direct superior, I had a sense that all he was concerned with was his career advancement. That's fine by me. Give me a master who ignores me, if I really must have one. I pray that I've read him correctly. That owning me is a status thing for him, a mark that his career is on the rise, the master and tamer of the previously uptight female executive who used to outrank him. A way to advance his career, not to titillate his sexual appetite, if he even has any. It strikes me that in a way, we're eerily similar. I'd never considered it, but he too places work ahead of everything else. Besides, I say in a soft whisper. Better you than. He eyes me, meaningfully. Then he nods. No words are spoken. None are needed. I know the ritual down to the tiniest detail, the payload's made sure of it. Every twitch and contraction of every single muscle in my body, coordinated into a choreography tailored to a man's tastes. A display of willing submission, surrender, acceptance. Silently, accepting the defeat of my entire gender, I slide down to my knees. There is a moment of significant silence between us, before he decides to stand up. Once again I feel the awe-inspiring experience of someone looming over me, except it's a man this time, and he seems so impossibly large now can't challenge him, must do what he says, must conform to his will, let it shape me like putty in his strong, manly hands. Actually, I don't believe I have a collar on me, he says, frowning. A distant part of me thinks that kind of kills the mood, but being here on my knees, the payload is deafening, drowning out every other thought. The idea of feeling anything but awe for this man seems completely impossible to me. I came prepared. I say. The most embarrassing purchase of my life, and a dangerous one too, but here goes nothing. With trembling hands I raise a collar up, like an offering to a blasphemous god. He gives a throaty chuckle at that, but picks it up, the merest brush of our fingertips sending jolts of electricity through me. And then, he bends forward, and the leather is touching my skin, and that elicits a small feminine gasp out of me, a sharp jolt against my clit. Then the collar snaps it around my throat, and I know the joy of unconditional surrender. It's like an orgasm of the mind, a rush of every chemical that makes a human feel good. I bend forward to kiss his shoes, like I did with Shannon, except this feels different, right? It's like I'm begging him for mercy, worshipping him like a literal god. Isn't that what men are like in the world now? Are gods? I consider myself owned. I say, and I hate that I love every single word. Although none of them still come close to that cursed, devastatingly arousing word. Celeste, I will not use you. Lance says, matter-of-factly. I almost feel disappointed by that, and that sends shame and disgust and arousal coursing through me. Of course my brainwashed feminine brain expects him to fuck me. It would be his right, girls don't get to say no, a woman's consent is irrelevant in this new world. What is a slave girl without a good fucking to put her in her place? It means she's useless, that she's failed. That's exactly why I picked him. I need to remind myself of this. I do everything I can to stay on top of my own thoughts, but it's so hard. I won't use you, but I do expect you to be subservient to me, and I have a first task to assign you. He says. We're going to a party. More specifically, a Christmas party. 4. Losing the war. I figured Lance wanted me to attend the Christmas party on his arm. As a companion or a trophy to show off. To raise his profile among the men who are his sole competitors, now that women have been vanquished. But as it turns out, this new world the payload is sculpting has a way of consistently subverting my expectations. Like I anticipated, no uncollared woman was reckless enough to attend this party. The occasion is a ceremony of male power, as one executive after another sips champagne or smokes a cigar in his power suit. The women present, they're all collared, and each has her place. Shannon is dressed in a sexy Santa costume, as she told me. She cozies up to the men, flirting and tittering, looking pretty and smiling radiantly, but she always gravitates back to her master, Sharp, who takes center stage as he parades with his conquest. Jasmine used to oversee logistics, so she acts as catering now, which seems oddly fitting, in a perverse sort of way that only the payload could ever make sound reasonable. Jen is currently busy serving drinks, and Francesca. I haven't seen her in quite some time, but it doesn't take a genius to figure out why. And then, there's me. I thought Lance wanted to parade me, too, but no. Instead, I'm lying on the floor, belly down, gagged and hogtied, under the Christmas tree. MMPPHH. I mumble in discomfort, my muscles burning from the unnatural position I've been forced in for the entirety of the night. It's clear most of the men are still uncomfortable with these displays. Wolf hasn't met my eyes once. But they're not exactly pushing back, are they? In fact, as the alcohol flows, and trousers begin to tent, a few of the men present are starting to lose their inhibitions. Touch and grope the girls who used to be their colleagues, or their bosses. I feel forgotten. Tossed away, like a toy. Sidelined in a way I could never have imagined before the payload. I wonder if Lance is trying to send me a message, or if it's just a rationalization motivated by the payload, but I feel like I'm just a piece of furniture. A silent observer, seen but not heard. This party is for them, for the men who still have autonomy, ambition, and hopes for career advancement. I've been forcefully expelled from that world. I'm not here as an employee, or even as a man's trophy catch, I'm a decoration. Brainless, immobilized, silent. Nothing more. God, I can't believe how good it feels, being held down like this while the men enjoy their drinks and smokes. My eyes are tearing up from the discomfort, but my arousal burns like a relentless fire. It's a terrifying feedback loop, one I recognize as the addiction induced by the payload. The more I realize how truly dehumanizing this situation is, the hotter it feels. The hotter it feels, the more I recognize it as dehumanizing. How long until it disassembles me? How long until I start begging to be subjugated? This is what will keep happening to every woman who yields to a collar, and eventually, we all will, I suspect. We'll keep racing down the spiral, humiliation and arousal feeding one another, building in strength, on and on, down the years. Forever. The rest of the evening goes by in a blur of soft conversations and the clink of glasses. My vision swims, and my mind wanders far away, to formless places made hazy by the mist of arousal and the irreversible defeat of feminism. I'm yanked back to reality by four pairs of leather shoes, resting right before my face. I should kiss them, but I can't, not with the gag in place. I crane my neck and roll my eyes upward, trying to catch a glimpse of the two overlords currently overshadowing me. The faces of Lance and Sharp look back at me, the former emotionless, the latter grinning with hunger. I've never felt so incredibly small. I'm basically a rag at their feet, a doormat. Even if the payload were to be undone tomorrow, how could they ever look at me as an equal again? Now that they know how easily a woman can be brought under control, tamed, domesticated. Like I promise, Lance says at last, breaking the awkward silence. She's yours now, my gift to you. Merry Christmas! I blink, confused, my eyes traveling from one man to the other. You haven't touched her? Sharp asks, seemingly inspecting me. I haven't touched her, Lance confirms. I've held up my side of the bargain. No. No, 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 no. And I'll hold up mine, Sharp says. But first, I have an old account I need to settle. And a Christmas gift to unwrap. I stare at Lance, my eyes wide with shock and fear. MMMPPHH. I moan through the gag, begging him to please protect me, to save me. But the stare that meets me is dead, like a shark's. Why would he do this? Why go through the bother? What am I worth to him? And then I remember. Sharp is taking my old place on the board. But who's replacing Sharp? Who's going to get a step up the company ladder, a pay hike, and the favor of a higher up? As horror washes over me, I recall my own assessment of Lance. He only cares about his job. He is ambitious above all things. He's ultimately not that interested in me. I'm his bargaining chip, his leverage to get a concession out of Sharp. An object, right? Brainless, immobilized, silent, and nothing more. Lance must notice the understanding that's dawned in my eyes. He acknowledges it with a curt nod. Nothing personal, sugar. He says. Sugar. This man who was several rings down from me in the company ladder, and who's just sold me like I'm a pound of flesh. But you really should have seen this coming. Leapfrogging several steps to a big promotion, that's hard. But collaring a woman these days? He makes a puffing sound with his mouth, shaking his head in amusement. Now, that's easy. I know it to be true. I know women are easily brought to heel, that the payload is turning us into a bunch of puppies waiting to be taught how to behave, that we're meek and docile to the point that we barely even qualify as people anymore. There's nothing about me that makes me specifically appealing to Lance. He can have anyone he wants, and cares to collar. It's Sharp, who cares about me in particular. Sharp, who wants to drive home his victory over me. Sharp, who wants to finally humiliate the rival who dared compete with him for a promotion. Who wants to literally and metaphorically shove his misogyny down my throat, together with his cock. Sharp, who is now untying me, clipping a leash to my collar, and summarily yanking and dragging me towards a private room, into the abyss. In my heart of hearts, I know this can't be true. As my defeated cunt clenches fiercely around Sharp's cock, seeking to milk it, to pay tribute to it, I take distant note of the fact that sex has never felt this good. No kind of sex. Certainly not rough, uncomplimentary penetration from my professional nemesis. My programming-addled brain is misfiring, malfunctioning as the payload wipes away my ability to form coherent words, or even to process this sensory overload in a more orderly way. Instead, it's like a nuke, blinding and frying everything in its path. I feel like my brains are leaking out of my cunt with my own juices. This isn't sex. Not really. My face is pressed into the bed, my back arched as Sharp plows into me, putting me in my place, fucking personhood itself out of me. This is about progressively dismantling me, humiliating me, dehumanizing me. It's about destroying the person I used to be, before the fall of women. And that's why it's way hotter than sex will ever have any hope to be. You think this is change? Sharp says, huffing and puffing, the cigar stench on his smoke perceptible even from down here. But just wait. Wolf will not be around forever, and when he goes, and I succeed him, you'll see real change. I whimper like a bitch in heat, the vision of the office degenerating into an oversexed fever dream melting the last of my resistance. We're really going to have a blowjob, Rota. I'm really going to be paid just to suck cock. But of course, Sharp will own my income. Fuck yes. He continues, driving deeper into me. This is what you get for going up against me. Stealing my job. Who's the fucking loser now, huh? I am. I shout, trying to apologize to him with every inch of my body, offered up to him for his own pleasure. That's right. He says. I've taken your job, your dignity, your freedom, your body, your mind. You win. I shout, experiencing defeat like a physical sensation, a shroud wrapping around every single ounce of my being. I surrender. It's my Christmas gift to you. Fuck. He says, and I know my slutty display, the way my curves and my mind both seem to be putty under his fingers, my unconditional surrender, are driving him closer to the edge. Making him lose his composure. In one swift motion, Sharp nails me down on the bed, and then pulls out of me. Before I know it, a hail of slaps rains on my face, stinging, humiliating. The pain radiates from my cheeks like a strange warmth, and the humiliation goes straight to my sex. Before I even know what's happening, Sharp yanks me by the hair, forcing me on all fours on the bed before him. And then, he pushes his cock into my mouth. MMPPHH. I mumble wordlessly. There was a time when the mere idea of taking his cock into my mouth was completely unthinkable. But now, it'd be unthinkable not to surrender my throat to him. Not to let him turn it into his warm cock sleeve. Want to finish down your throat. He says. Shut you up for good. And he has, in more ways than one. I've been muzzled, leashed and brought to heel, turned into a bitch, a sex pet. I'm not a person anymore. How could I ever call this man my rival, my subordinate? Any time he could have gotten fed up with my uptight feminist attitude, and just, utterly defeated me. He must be thinking similar thoughts, so close as he is to the edge of climax, because I've barely had an opportunity to make any use of my skills before his dick begins to quiver. I make sure to seal my lips tightly around it, like a vacuum, ready to accept his seed. That's the act of ultimate submission, I know, devotedly taking someone's load like this, but that's what I'm for. That's what all women are for. As rope after rope of cum shoots into my mouth and down my throat, my eyes go wide, and I experience the full, unfettered reward of the payload. It's divine, like every part of my body is experiencing its own orgasm, and there's nothing I wouldn't do to feel this again. I understand why collared women are not to be trusted. I'm one of them now, and this is my new religion. You know, slut. Sharp says above me, panting and heaving, his half-erect cock still firmly lodged between my conquered lips. I saw your face, back at that meeting. The way your eyes went glassy when you heard that word. The desperate, animalistic whimper rising from my throat is so eager that it surprises even me. But Sharp just smiles, knowing he struck gold. I brace myself, because I know he's going to say it now, to finally ruin me forever, and I don't know whether I should curse him for it, or thank him. You're inferior to men, and don't belong in an executive office unless you're under the desk. That's why you've been demoted.
I squeal like a filthy pig around his cock, the word coursing through me like a muscular spasm, a rippling sensation that seems to strip me of all my defenses. I stare up at him with large, adoring eyes, knowing it's the only look men will be getting from womankind from now on.
Think about it. All your life, you thought you had a chance, at least.
And look what happened.
You beat a man to a coveted job, and around comes a mind control virus, of all things, and what's the first thing I do?
I exploit it immediately. To demote you. The words are devastating, enough to bring me close to climax all by themselves, because he's right. The monsters were always with us, walking among us, kept at bay by the thinnest veneer of social civility. The very moment us women became defenseless, we were seized. Reduced. Put back in our place. All my life, I lived in blissful ignorance of this sword dangling over my head. And now,
you will never rise again.
Sharp says, his cock once more beginning to stiffen inside my mouth.
Not you, not women. This is all you can aspire to from now on. To seek the next thrill, humiliation after humiliation, your whole existence devoted to us. Because all women, every single one of you, have been demoted.
He shouts the last word, but even still, it's drowned out by my desperate, throaty moan. The most cataclysmic orgasm of my entire life ripples outward from my sex like a shockwave, making every muscle flex as my eyes roll back into my skull. I arch my back in pleasure, impaling myself further on Sharp's cock. With every second of this otherworldly pleasure, there is less and less of me, more and more of the payload perfected sex slave and serving girl I'll be for the rest of my life. As the last vestiges of the old Celeste succumb to the all-encompassing tidal wave of my pleasure, I finally accept one incontrovertible fact. Women have lost the war.
The end.
You have been listening to this podcast on the Erotica Podcast Network. Please visit our other podcasts. Their links are in the description of this episode. The Erotica Podcast and the Erotica Taboo Podcast offer $2 subscriptions, which opens up bonus content.